Critical Mass Publishing presents Spirit Breaker and Coffin Collector by William Massa. Read for you by James Foster. The story so far. After a decade spent fighting the enemy abroad and keeping his country safe, Delta Force operator Mark Talon is ready to settle down with the love of his life. But Talon's world crumbles when his fiancée becomes the victim of a murderous cult. In the wake of his terrible loss, Talon dedicates himself to a new mission, hunting down twisted occultists around the globe and stopping them before they can unleash the forces of darkness upon an unsuspecting world. In Spirit Breaker, Talon must battle the terrifying forces of the afterlife. Chapter 1. The Dead Walked the Earth, at least for today. It was Dia de los Muertos, the Day of the Dead, and the streets of Mexico City bustled with morbid activity. Lucas Espinosa peered from the second-story window of his nightclub and soaked in the preternatural scene unfolding outside. A bobbing sea of skeletons, coffins, and death masks streamed through the arteries of the city, the procession moving to the steady, hypnotic beat of pounding drums. His probing gaze roamed the mob. As one of Mexico's top drug lords, Espinosa knew how to spot cops. His trained eye picked out the heavily armed police guards from the crowd, their presence unable to spoil the celebration. He chose not to worry about the law enforcement officers. If any screams should escape from his club, the drums and shouts of the surging congregation below would drown them out. The festive atmosphere outside was the fusion of ancient Aztec beliefs in death with the Catholic celebrations of All Saints' Day. While the people below used this day to reconnect with deceased friends, family members, and ancestors, Espinosa directed his prayers to Santa Muerte. Unlike traditional Catholic saints, Santa Muerte wasn't the spirit of a living person, but the personification of death itself. The Grim Reaper was the perfect deity for a man in his line of work. Besides the nightclub, Espinosa's business empire counted sweatshops, drugs, and murder among its many revenue streams. Most people who worshipped the goddess offered cigars, chocolate, tequila, or fruit. They were deceiving themselves if they thought the Reapress could ever be satisfied with such frivolous tokens of their adoration. To Espinosa's mind, Santa Muerte only accepted the currency of blood, and he was about to make his payment. A muffled moan emanated from the large space behind him, and Espinosa shifted his attention away from the festivities. Deep shadows cloaked the storage room on the top floor of his building. Usually it contained a few crates of alcohol, a dusty desk, and a ratty couch. His eyes locked on the nude beauty dangling from the ceiling at the center of the room. She was strung up by her feet like a hog, the rope secured around steel rafters, her tawny body pointing toward the ground. The woman's tight, small breasts somehow defied gravity as her long black hair, now caked with sweat and fear, brushed the dusty wooden floor. Her listless expression suggested a deep resignation to her fate. The woman's name was Camilla, and she was a 19-year-old dancer at the club, and she would die today by his hand. Three robed, hooded figures surrounded the beauty, their faces painted like grisly skulls. Just like Espinosa, each figure wielded a rusty machete and was waiting for him to give them the word. Honoring Santa Muerte with human blood sacrifices had helped Espinosa secure supernatural protection and success in his extensive business dealings. Fewer and fewer of his drug shipments were being seized by U.S. border guards since he'd started carrying out the rituals. It was almost as if Santa Muerte's magic made his trucks invisible to the prying gringo's eyes. The thought of what lay ahead sent a thrill up his spine, and he clutched his machete tighter. As the leader, he would strike the first blow. Soon enough, metal would rend flesh, and the plastic tarp underneath the catatonic girl would turn a dark red. His instructions to his men were clear. The blows were to be aimed at the torso and extremities as to extend the suffering of the sacrifice. The more savage the victim's death, the greater the future reward from the goddess. For a beat, he peered into the woman's eyes. He wanted, needed, to see the lights go out as she transitioned from the world of the living to the realm of the dead. Espinosa sucked in a sharp breath and addressed the Grim Reaper. "Please accept my offering, Santa Muerte." His hands trembling with excitement, he raised his machete, summoned all the savage energy he could muster, and brought down the blade. Sharp steel hurtled toward vulnerable flesh. Then a second machete shot out and blocked the incoming blow with a clang that reverberated through the storage room. Sparks flew as one of the robed men parried Espinosa's death blow. The drug lord glared at the fool who dared to interrupt the sacrifice. Even though Talon knew the Halloween getup made him look like a member of Espinosa's brotherhood, his eyes would give him away. They belonged to a different breed of killer than Espinosa's thugs. Grim understanding flooded the drug lord's features as he realized someone had managed to infiltrate his sacrificial circle. The goon Talon was impersonating was still seeping red in the alley that ran along Espinosa's club, Talon's own personal offering to the goddess of death. It would be the first of many. Before Espinosa could retaliate, Talon brought up the machete and slashed the blade across the drug lord's exposed neck in one lightning-fast move. A second mouth opened below the first, and a shocked Espinosa grabbed his gushing throat with horror. Blood splashed the nude victim, whose eyes were now wild with panic. As Espinosa slammed onto the tarp with a wet smack, Talon spun around just in time to meet the two descending machetes of Espinosa's soldiers. Steel clanged against steel as the men hacked away at him, while their leader convulsed and hemorrhaged at their feet. His rattling death gurgle was drowned out by the intense grunts of combat. Talon parried the first few blows and chopped at the arm of one of his attackers. The man let out a guttural roar and stumbled backward, spraying crimson. The second cultist drove Talon back, his hungry blade slicing the air left and right, seemingly everywhere. One more inch and he would have taken the top of Talon's head off, definitely too close for comfort. His opponent's attacks became faster and more intense. Making matters worse, the massive bastard outweighed Talon by about 50 pounds and knew how to use his weight to his advantage. Espinosa's soldier rushed Talon, machete up, and pushed him against the wall with ferocious force. Blinding dust showered down Talon's face. Without hesitation, he headbutted the skull face, pulverizing cartilage. The machete-wielding cultist backed away with a sharp curse. From the corner of his peripheral vision, Talon caught movement. The first man had dropped his blade and was drawing a pistol. Talon spun and launched his machete at the cultist. The knife cut through the air and found its target with the wet thud of steel burying into flesh. The cultist crumbled. Unarmed, Talon faced the incoming beast of a man he'd headbutted seconds earlier. The cultist's face paint was coated in perspiration, the white and black running together, distorting the features until they barely seemed human. The onrushing machete missed Talon by a hair's breadth and bit into the wall where it lodged itself in the wooden framing beneath the plaster. Before the attacker could dislodge the machete and launch another attack, Talon snatched the man's forearm and twisted it with martial arts precision. There was a sound of bone giving way, followed by the machete clanging against the floor. He drove his elbow with savage efficiency into the cultist's throat, crushing the man's larynx. The cultist collapsed and stopped moving. Talon took a step back, sucking in deep gulps of air while wiping the sweat off his features. He regarded the downed enemy for a beat before he turned toward the terrified naked woman still swinging from the ceiling. Her eyes met his with a haunted expression. She was in shock, and who couldn't blame the poor girl? Talon cut her down. Arms around her waist, he gently lowered her to the floor. He tore the duct tape from her mouth and offered up his robe so she could cover herself with it. Considering the state she was in, modesty probably was the last thing on her mind. Nevertheless, she eagerly clutched the robe and draped it over her naked form. Approaching footsteps sounded from below. The fight had alerted Espinosa's men. Talon scoped the room, picked up the pistol the cultist had dropped, and considered his options. Blasting his way out of there was one option, but he doubted he'd get far. An army was waiting for him on the lower floor of the club. He might be able to defeat the first group of men, but reinforcements would quickly take their place once the shooting began. Talon scanned the windows. He could use the fire escape and make a go for the roof, but there was the matter of the girl. In her current condition, they'd never reach the roof in time. As these thoughts wheeled through his mind, he sensed someone creeping up behind him. He made out a flash of steel as Camilla drove a knife into him. Sharp metal cut through skin and muscle, and Talon gasped, more out of anger with himself than pain. He'd let his guard down, and now it would cost him dearly. The woman's eyes glittered with fanatical savagery. All this time, he'd viewed her as a helpless victim. when in reality she was a willing participant in this madness. Battling the occult shared a crucial element in common with fighting terrorism. Sometimes it was difficult to establish who the good guys were. This was an asymmetrical conflict where the line between friend and foe could easily blur and distort. Talon wondered what would make a young woman welcome such a brutal end. Then again, how different was it from the young men and women who were willing to blow themselves up in the name of their god? There was no time to dwell on it. Talon's heart grew cold as he drove his fist into the beauty's face. She collapsed in a string-cut sprawl, her unconscious head hitting the tarp right next to Espinoza, who stared at her with blank, dead eyes from behind a mask of gore. Talon cursed as he clutched the knife handle jutting from his side and wrenched it out with a grunt of pain. Blood flowed freely and his legs shook. A bad situation had gotten worse. For a moment he swayed and leaned against the wall. Espinoza's men were almost upon him. In a few seconds, they'd burst through the door, guns blazing. Talon eyed the lifeless cultists, and a ghost of a smile played on his skull-painted face. There might still be a way out of this death trap. When Espinoza's crew arrived, all they saw was four downed men and an unconscious woman. Talon heard their panicked curses and shouts as they swept the scene of carnage. The gangsters might be inured to death, but the sight of their fallen leader clearly shook them. Through slitted eyes, Talon saw one of the men cross himself and mutter a prayer. "Go on and pray to your saint of death," he thought. "She won't save you now." One of Espinoza's men barked orders, and most of the cultists filed out of the storage area on their way to the roof. The two guards who stayed behind never noticed the hooded figure rising from the floor behind them, never saw him level a pistol. Only when the shots rang out did their fatal oversight become apparent. But by then it was too late. Santa Muerte had found two new victims. Three heavily armed men blocked the staircase on the ground floor of the club. There was a flicker of instinctive fear as their eyes landed on the skull-faced man who had appeared seemingly out of nowhere. By the time they had brought up their guns, Talon's bullets were already shattering bone and tissue in crimson bursts. They collapsed in the narrow staircase, and Talon climbed over their lifeless bodies. Within seconds, he located the door that led into the club's kitchen. The staff instinctively pulled away from the gun-wielding figure, leaving a trail of crimson in its wake. Talon surged toward the steel door in the back and found himself in the same alley where he'd earlier stashed the body of the cultist he was impersonating. He stumbled down the passageway and heard shouts from above as the men on the roof spotted him. Bullets rained down, chopping cement, but missed Talon's weaving form. The din of the Day of the Dead procession drowned out the gunshots. By the time their magazines were empty, Talon had already merged with the crowd of revelers, just another skeleton in a long line of the marching dead. As he let the crowd push him onward, he clutched his side, hoping to staunch the flow of blood. No one paid heed to his wound, or, if they did, they most likely thought it was a creative touch to his costume. Talon felt on the verge of sensory overload. He caught glimpses of elaborately decorated altars on the side of the surging throng. The ofrendas were built from human bones and other offerings. Drums rattled his teeth and seemed to mirror the pounding of his own heart. Skeletons and skulls leered at him as the spooky parade masks ghosted through the crowd. He thought he spotted Zagan's mechanical death skull in the bobbing parade. He tried to rationalize the terrible vision, to blame it on the loss of blood, but some uncertainty lingered. Anything was possible in this new war, wasn't it? Could the dead truly rise on this day? Could the monsters he'd defeated in the last 6 months return to torment him? There'd been so much killing, so much death. Another figure jostled him, and he thought he saw Rezok's face in his fiberglass skull mask. He squinted, filled his lungs with air, and pressed the fabric of his black shirt against his injury. Clenching his jaw, he pressed on, one agonizing step after another. If he collapsed, he would either bleed out or end up in the hands of the Mexican authorities. He doubted that even Casca could bail him out of a Mexican jail. Not that he'd ever arrive at the police precinct. He was a dead man if the authorities found him. About a third of the police force was on Espinoza's payroll. No, he needed to make it to the hotel, take care of the injury, get some rest, and head for the airport once he was strong enough. Somehow he managed to cling to consciousness until he reached the Hilton, which was located 3 minutes from the Hidalgo metro station. Even though he resembled one of the risen dead, no one paid him any mind. Ghosts outnumbered the living today. As soon as he staggered into his room, he lurched into the bathroom and snatched a bottle of pills from his first aid kit. He washed down the antibiotics with a shot of tequila before pouring some of the booze on his wounded side. He gasped with agony as the alcohol disinfected the wound. Luckily for him, the woman had wielded the blade with little force and missed all vital organs and arteries. Already the bleeding had slowed. He climbed into the shower and let the scalding hot water wash the makeup from his face and clean his wound. Black and white paint pooled around his feet, mixing with his blood before disappearing down the drain. Talon didn't remember turning off the water or stitching up and bandaging the cut. Didn't remember collapsing on the bed. Just before blackness swept over him, he had one last vision. Michelle's beautiful, smiling face. Talon's next memory was the sensation of brilliant sunlight streaming through his hotel room. He looked at the clock and saw he'd been out for over 16 hours. He rubbed his pounding head, squinting at the brilliant light, and rose to his feet. The day of the dead had come and gone, and Talon was ready to return to the world of the living. Chapter 2. Karen admired her boyfriend's profile in the moonlight as he steered his Porsche Cayman into the small, secluded park. His jet-black hair, olive skin, and striking eyes, which alternated between gray and green depending on the light, still made her weak at the knees even after 11 months of dating. "So, in case you missed this little detail," she said, "we just passed a sign that says the park closes at 10 and violators will be ticketed." "Well, that's too bad." Gary winked at her mischievously, oozing confidence. He was definitely the wilder one in the relationship. Sometimes Karen wondered what he saw in her. And late at night, when he lay sound asleep next to her, she questioned how long they'd last as a couple. They were different in so many ways, but then again, opposites did attract, right? After nearly a year, Gary still seemed to be interested in her. Maybe her conservative, cautious temperament reined in his more impulsive tendencies. "Or maybe he just likes the shape of my ass," she thought. "What's going through your mind?" Gary asked. "Just thinking how romantic this is," she said. "Cruising into an empty park, breaking laws." "We haven't broken any laws. At least not yet." His eyes sparkled with good humor and a smile tugged at his lips. The car rolled to a stop and Gary turned off the engine. The brilliant light of the Porsche's headlights starkly outlined the park's playground ahead of them. Karen made out a metal slide, a jungle gym, a merry-go-round, and a few other attractions that would delight the tykes. The rest remained cloaked in the shadows of the trees that lined the playground area. Being a first-grade teacher at a nearby elementary school, she'd visited the park hundreds of times, but always during the day when it was filled with the laughter and squeals of playing children. The playsets now stood abandoned, haunted and forlorn in the milky light. A low wind sent a pair of swings moving, the chains squeaking eerily in the nocturnal landscape. A thick fog was rolling in, adding to the spooky atmosphere as it rapidly devoured the playground.
"Yep. This place is friggin' creepy at night," Karen thought.
She suddenly wished they'd just headed straight to her apartment. Almost as if Gary sensed her anxiety, he leaned closer. An instant later, his hungry lips found hers. Immediately, all worries were pushed aside by the shivers of delight traveling down her body.
God, the man knew how to kiss.
Karen almost expected a police officer to materialize outside the Porsche and shine a flashlight down at them. How embarrassing would that be?
Damn it, why couldn't she just relax and go with the flow?
Her overactive imagination was like a blessing and a curse. How she wished she could be a little more carefree and spontaneous like Gary. He clearly was hoping to take their makeout session further, but her guard remained up. She'd die from embarrassment if the cops caught them in the throes of some lewd act. Karen gently pushed against his chest and pulled away. She felt bad about spoiling the party, but he seemed cool about it. She loved how he kept trying to coax her out of her comfort zone, but also knew when to back down. Another reason she was so crazy about him. Gary grinned. "I think we better get a room, huh?" He started the car while Karen straightened her hair and fixed her makeup. The car jolted suddenly, causing Karen to smudge her lipstick. Her face fell as she made out the thump of rubber and metal scraping over cement, the telltale sign of a flat tire.
"Great. This night just keeps getting better."
Had they been unlucky enough to roll over a nail or a piece of glass as they entered the park? Gary killed the engine and squeezed her hand reassuringly. "No worries. I've got a spare."
"Don't you think we should just call AAA?
"I've changed a tire before. Just stay in the car. It's going to be a little chilly out there."
He kissed her on the cheek before stepping outside. The door slammed shut behind him. She watched him walk up to the hood where the spare was stored in the Porsche Cayman. For a minute, his face danced before the steamy windshield, and Karen turned on the wipers. She enjoyed seeing her man getting his hands dirty. Gary grabbed the spare and headed for the back of the Porsche. Tools banged against the frame of the vehicle as he mounted the tire. Bored, Karen snatched her phone from her purse and started to flip through her latest emails. She'd probably checked her messages about 1,000 times over the course of the day, another irritating habit she vowed to break in the near future. She'd almost caught up with all her social media when she became aware of the unnatural silence that had descended over the park. She turned her head toward the rear windshield but detected no sign of her beau. Strange. Fog fully enveloped the Porsche now, erasing most of the playground from view. Her pulse quickened as a terrible loneliness settled over her. What should she do? Roll down her window and call out for Gary? The mist blowing past the windows made it seem like a bad idea. "Hey, Gary! What's going on out there?" she shouted. There was no response. The fog thickened. The silence deepened. Just as she decided to text him, her cell chirped and a message from Gary lit up the screen. Initial relief turned to horror as she realized the screen showed a picture of her boyfriend covered in gore. "Oh my God, no." Her breath hitched as terror washed over her. The sudden hiss of a spray canister made Karen almost jump out of her seat. She spun toward the rear window as a concentrated stream of blue spray paint hit the glass. She whirled just as a second hiss filled the night, and a fiery red blast of paint streaked the front windshield. With trembling fingers, she reached for the ignition key. A hooded figure stepped out of the mist. Ripped jeans, a black hoodie, face shrouded in darkness. An urban spook. A web of runny paint obscured the silhouette, but Karen could still make out the baseball bat in the stranger's hands. A second later, the bat came crashing down on the windshield, and Karen's world turned into an explosion of glass. When the black veil of unconsciousness finally lifted, Karen found herself lying on a cold, hard floor. She inhaled dusty air and then choked. Where was she? What had happened? She remembered the incoming baseball bat, the shattering glass, the gloved hands reaching through the broken windshield. The assailants had fought their way into the Porsche and then dragged her out of the vehicle where someone zapped her with a taser. As she'd hit the ground, a boot had swung toward her head. Afterwards, there had only been blackness. Until now. Karen stifled another cough and groggily took in her surroundings. She found herself in an enclosed, high-ceilinged space. She lay at the center of a maze of bolted-down tables covered in a thick layer of grime. The dirt-streaked, broken signs of a number of fast-food restaurants loomed above her. Where was she? What was this place? In the distance, crumbling storefronts were tagged with graffiti. A tangle of wires and cables dangled from cracks in the walls, as if the building's intestines were breaking through the stone skin. Sickly light filtered through a cracked skylight overhead and illuminated twin escalators in the near distance. Karen suddenly realized where she was. It had to be in the old regional mall, which had closed its doors during the recession. The shopping center had stood empty for years, narrowly avoiding demolition. Eyesore for some, spooky attraction to others, it was a symbol of 21st century economic decline. Who needed a mall when it was cheaper to shop online? Investigating the dead mall more closely, Karen noticed a small bonfire burning nearby. Flames flickered and drew grotesque shadows. The bonfire reminded her that she wasn't alone in the desolate shopping center. A shudder passed through her and the sense of terror returned. They'd brought her to this forsaken place for a reason. Somewhere in the darkened concourse, her abductors lurked. And this made her think of Gary, his face covered in a mask of blood. Oh, God. What had they done to him? Tears welled up at the thought of her boyfriend's blood-streaked features, and she stifled a sob. No, she couldn't let them see her break down like this. Wouldn't give those bastards the satisfaction. Her eyes bored into the darkness. There was no sign of her hooded abductors. Karen expected her kidnappers to show themselves and make their move any moment now, but the mall remained eerily still. What the hell are they waiting for? The answer to the question popped into her mind a second later. They're drawing it out, playing with me. This is some sick game to them. God, she'd somehow stumbled into her own personal horror show. Karen took a few cautious, wobbly steps, legs trembling beneath her, muscles still stiff from the taser attack and prolonged period of inactivity. Her shoes clacked against the stone floor, echoing creepily in the cavernous space. With an unsteady gait, she approached the bonfire, the flames casting a hypnotic spell. Fire was greedily consuming her personal belongings, her coach purse, Sephora makeup kit, Tiffany necklace, and iPhone.
"Why are you doing this to me?"
There was no force to her words, her voice breathless with terror. She paused, not really expecting an answer, and was rewarded with the explosive hiss of an aerosol spray can. She pivoted, eyes searching, trying to determine the direction the sound was coming from. Her eyes landed on a human silhouette. The figure lurked about 30 feet away, a shadow in the dark mall. The stranger just stood there, watching, biding his time. Karen began to retreat, putting some distance between herself and the kidnapper. She reached a stone column and stumbled upon a message scrawled in bright red graffiti. "I shop, therefore I am." The paint bleeding down the wall was still fresh. Karen shifted her attention back to the ominous figure in the hoodie, but he'd vanished. Terror mounting, Karen continued walking away from the food court toward a row of shops. She vaguely recalled the main exits being inside JCPenney and Sears, if she could make it to either end of the mall. Who was she kidding? They would never let her get away. Better to just stay put and face what was coming with open eyes. They were in control here, whoever they might be. Another hiss emanated from a shadowy corner behind her. A dark realization clawed itself into her manic thoughts. She was dealing with multiple stalkers. She bit her lip to stave off her panic and tasted coppery blood. Words tore through her mind and Karen realized it was a prayer. Her pace picking up, she stumbled deeper into the former shopping center, catching a glimpse of another graffiti message. A skull, but there was something strange about the image. Where the teeth should be, there was a pattern of parallel lines of varying widths. Beneath the row of alternating thick and thin bars, she made out a series of numbers. Understanding flooded her scarred face. The skull's jaw was a barcode. Karen remembered seeing this barcode skull on the news a few years back, knew the deeper significance of this symbol. Oh God, this couldn't be happening to her. She shook with panic as she yelled, "What the hell do you want from me?" There was no answer. Instead, wheels rippled over the stone floor, and two men in hoodies shot from the darkness on skateboards. The urban monks cut off Karen's escape, forcing her to retrace her steps. A third hoodie stepped into the ragged patch of moonlight behind her, blocking the concourse. He was decked out in a spray painter's mask. Darth Vader aiming for street cred. Karen let out a choked scream when she spotted the long curved knife in the hooded tagger's hand. The figure took another step toward her. Karen snapped, adrenaline and fear propelling her into motion. She whirled around and broke into a run. She had almost reached the escalators when an invisible force stopped her dead in her tracks and whipped her back, sending her flying. For a moment she was airborne, then she hit the ground hard, the world spinning around her. Stunned, she craned her neck upward, expecting to see hooded faces leering down at her. But she was alone. There was no trace of a human presence. Her breath clouded in the air before her and she shivered. The temperature must have dropped by at least 10 degrees. She crawled back to her feet and inspected her shirt. The strange collision had shredded the fabric. The skin beneath the torn blouse was mottled by a series of black burn marks, sensitive to the touch. Adrenaline was keeping the pain at bay, but Karen knew it wouldn't last. What was happening here? Karen turned and saw the hoodies had returned. They loomed in the near distance, outlined in the pale moonlight, a ring of wraiths barring her escape. Why had they given up the chase? Had they tired of this horrible game? And what had tripped her in such a violent manner? A chilling whisper interrupted her racing thoughts. Death is only the beginning. Her heart pounded in a deafening drumbeat. She tilted her gaze toward the ceiling. She could feel her face twisting with horror, her lips distorting into a scream. A vaguely human form hung upside down from the mall ceiling, suspended like a spider. With a guttural shriek, the apparition launched toward Karen, bony hands hurtling toward her throat. Karen screamed. Chapter 3. Talon was a man without a home. He constantly traveled the globe, devoted to his personal quest of keeping mankind safe from occult enemies. Before signing up for the dark missions that now defined his life, he'd been a Delta operator, and his work had kept him on the go in a similar fashion. In a way, this had always been his reality, his calling. After dealing with Espinoza, the question was where he should head next.
The world was his oyster nowadays. Every month, Koska transferred $25,000 into his bank account, payment for services rendered. The military had taken care of his needs for the last 10 years, and Koska was fulfilling the same role now, albeit at a higher income bracket. Talon didn't obsess about material wealth. He never would have become a professional soldier if money were that important to him. Nevertheless, he appreciated the freedom to go wherever he damned pleased. For a moment, he considered San Francisco. Staying close to Koska for when duty would call again might be a smart move. But San Francisco was filled with memories of Michelle, and he was just managing to put a little distance between his past and the present. Instead, he decided to book a flight to Sarasota, where his old army buddy Rob had embarked on a promising career in law enforcement. The next day, Talon arrived in Florida and checked in at his hotel. Rob had invited him for dinner that night, and he was a little bit nervous about spending time with Rob's wife and 4-year-old son. He had originally figured they would grab some drinks the way they had back in the old days, but Rob wanted him to meet his clan. Talon couldn't show up at his friend's house empty-handed, so he proceeded to stop off at the local Toys R Us before dinner. Walking into the store, he was confronted with a new challenge. What to get a kid in 2015? He settled on a couple of Star Wars action figures. Ringing Rob's doorbell, Talon felt more nervous than he had when facing down the army of thugs in Mexico City. He could hit a moving target at 1,000 yards, but this social gathering was making him break into a sweat. He'd been out of the game too long. A dinner with Rob's family should have been the most normal activity in the world, but over the last few months, Talon's definition of normal had irrevocably changed. His nerves calmed slightly the moment the door opened and Rob smiled at him. The sandy-haired baby face clashed with the 220-pound frame, which now leaned in to give him a hearty bro hug. "Man, it's great to see you. Come on in." Stepping into Rob's home, meeting his lovely wife Maria and his adorable kid felt surreal. After months of wearing his armor, it was difficult for Talon to just sit down and fall back into the rhythm of civilian life. His friends had no idea about the occult war he was waging nowadays, but Rob knew firsthand the challenges returning soldiers faced. Thankfully, Maria turned out to be a delightful hostess, and the kid was thrilled about the present. 2 beers and a shot of Jack finally took the edge off the social gathering, and after dinner, Talon and Rob relaxed in the living room while they watched the kid give the action figures a workout.
"You didn't have to do that," Rob told him.
"Someone has to keep the galaxy safe." Rob offered him another beer, and Talon popped it open.
"Thanks." They sipped in silence for a moment.
"Look at you," Talon said. "You got it all. The wife, the kid, the picket fence. Who would have thought that crazy punk I met 10 years ago would ever grow up?"
"Hey, I'm not that grown up. I got tickets to the Metallica concert next month."
Talon grinned. They'd bonded over their love of the hard rock band in the army. 2 wild kids ready to protect the world and make a difference. In their own way, they were still doing so. In the days that followed, Talon and Rob tried to hit up every watering hole in town while reminiscing about the past. During the day while Rob was at work, Talon visited Siesta Key Beach for long walks and even longer swims. The Gulf of Mexico was warm, the salt water soothing his injury. While he sliced through the bobbing waves with powerful strokes, the ocean stinging his eyes and the sun beating down on him, he let his thoughts wander. For a moment, the horrors seemed far away. The natural beauty of this tropical paradise didn't seem to allow for the existence of demonic villainy. Talon knew it was an illusion, but he welcomed it anyway. He also couldn't help but notice the tanned, bikini-clad beauties who filled the beach at all times of the day. The week he spent with Kristen in Norway had reminded him that he was still a man with needs. Even though his heart would always belong to Michelle, he could allow himself to draw momentary comfort in the arms of another. After a week of the lazy life, he returned to his hotel one day to find a message on his cell phone. Koska had left instructions to check out a few internet links he'd forwarded to Talon's email account. Judging from the urgent tone in the billionaire's voice, the lull in the fighting was over. Chapter 4. As soon as Talon finished listening to Koska's message, he checked his email and clicked the links in question. They routed him to 3 videos hosted on a website that showcased material too edgy and dangerous for YouTube. Talon played the first video. A skull and crossbones image flickered against a black background, and Talon noticed that the skull's teeth had been replaced with a barcode. A beat later, a shot of a parked Mercedes filled the screen.
Three guys decked out in faceless hoodies, sporting crowbars and baseball bats, closed in on the luxury car and went medieval on the vehicle. The car alarm wailed. The sheer aggression on display was raw and real and in your face. Metal twisted, glass spiderwebbed, canisters of spray paint hissed, streaks of color bleeding over the luxury vehicle, leaving behind crude graffiti of pentagrams and inverted crosses. The camera zoomed in on the Mercedes and revealed a screaming driver cuffed to his steering wheel. One hoodie liberally sprayed him with lighter fluid, while another tossed a match into the car, igniting the driver. The bone-chilling screams of the human torch echoed. Part of Talon wanted nothing more in the world than to kill the video, but he forced himself to endure it to the bitter end. Casca had sent him the link for a reason. He needed to know who his new enemy was. The next video showed variations on the same barbaric theme. A group of ratty skater punks circled two terrified men dressed in expensive suits. They projected an air of wealth and power, and Talon thought they looked like they might be bankers or lawyers. The hoodies destroyed their cell phones, Rolex watches, and tablets before turning their attention toward the well-heeled professionals themselves. The video spared no details as aluminum bats connected with the hapless victims. Pitiful pleas for mercy alternated with grunts of pain. Talon was a battle-hardened killer, but torture and cruelty sickened him. His greatest fear while serving as an operator had been to be captured by an enemy intent on making his exit from this world as unpleasant as possible. In his mind, war should be a life-and-death battle between two professional soldiers. Torture was the domain of psychopaths and cowards. Too bad the world rarely lived up to his ideals. In the final video, hoodies had invaded a lush property. An attractive couple was dragged toward a luxury pool that glittered in their home's lights. Their hands were cuffed behind their backs, and Talon knew with a growing sense of dread where this was headed. The man was shouting, rage twisting his features, while the woman was crying and shaking with terror. No one heard their pleas as the home invaders tossed the couple into the deep end of the pool. Splashing water gave way to desperate gasps for air, foam erupting from lips unwilling to accept death. Talon's phone suddenly chirped with an incoming text, mercifully providing an excuse to turn off the horror show. Did you check out the links? Instead of answering the text, Talon called Casca on Skype. The billionaire appeared on his laptop. Somehow, his benefactor managed to exude wealth and sophistication even through his webcam. His classically handsome features and sense of style seemed more suited for a male model than an occult expert. Like himself, Simon Casca had been marked by the dark forces at an early age when a cult invaded his home and murdered his sister. Before the cultists could finish him off, the FBI had arrived on the scene and saved his life. Who knew how Casca would have turned out if not for his past tragedy? He probably would be living the high life, dating models without a care in the world. To be fair, Casca did maintain a front as a rich playboy, but there was a gravity behind the mask, a sense of mission that they shared in common. Both Talon and Casca had declared war on the forces of darkness. So far, they'd won their battles, but the war was still young. "What the hell did you just make me look at?" Talon asked. "I'm sorry, Sergeant, but you need to know what you might be up against." "These videos weren't taken recently. Looks like they were uploaded a few years back," Talon pointed out. "That's correct," Casca confirmed. "During the recession of 2008, a group of skaters, runaways, and anarchists committed acts of terror across the Midwest, which soon turned violent. The barcode skull became the identifying symbol of this satanic death cult, which mostly targeted members of the 1%. Psychologists and sociologists deemed it a social manifestation of economic inequality." "I call it a freak show. Making a boatload of cash is bad, but killing people is okay?" Talon shook his head. "Another example of fanatics leading willing sheep to the slaughter," he thought grimly. Would mankind ever learn to turn out the dark siren call of extremist ideology? "Did the cops catch these monsters?" Talon asked. "Fortunately, yes. It all came to a head when their leader, Robert Schiller, nicknamed the Reaper by the press, gathered the most fanatical members of the group and went on a shooting spree at the regional National Mall in Hampton, Ohio. He and his followers murdered 25 people that day before the authorities took them out." "Someone deserves a medal," Talon said through gritted teeth. He was shaking with rage. The sadistic torture videos had worked him up, raising the memories of Michelle's horrific death video once more. Not only had these bastards tortured innocents, but they'd been proud of it, too, had wanted to show it off for the world to see. Talon typed Schiller's name into his laptop's search engine, and a haunting face appeared. Talon immediately understood why the press had nicknamed Schiller the Reaper. The mass murderer staring back at him was bald, his neck and chest covered in satanic tattoos with the barcode skull taking center stage on his throat. Skin stretched tightly over his gaunt, emaciated features, the bones sharply outlined. A skull wearing the mask of a man. Body shots revealed Schiller to be 6'4", bone thin without a gram of body fat on his ropey frame. So why are we looking at the work of a deceased cult leader?
It appears that Schiller's work has inspired a copycat cult. There have been reports of 4 new kidnapping cases in Hampton, Ohio over the course of the last week that bear the M.O. of the Reaper Gang. Same graffiti signature, similar high-income targets, crime scenes characterized by acts of vandalism.
Schiller's freak show is back on, said Talon.
I'm afraid so. The police haven't found any bodies, but it's probably just a matter of time.
Talon sighed. I guess the vacation is over.
I'm sorry, Sergeant.
No worries. I was getting bored out here anyway. Beach, babes, and sun just can't compete with demons and killer cults.
Nice to see you haven't lost your sense of humor.
Koska grew more serious as he added,
Be careful out there. We don't know yet what we're dealing with.
Koska's words illustrated a problem Talon faced every time he tracked down an occult lead or investigated a paranormal case. Many of the cultists they hunted turned out to be dabblers, amateurs like Espinoza, who believed they could conjure evil forces but were a long way from achieving their goals. But sometimes the horror was real. Talon wouldn't know what he was up against until he was right smack in the middle of it. He touched the pentacle pendant that had saved him back in San Francisco and in Arizona. His guns and knives were great against mortal enemies, but pretty much useless against a true agent of darkness. Was this copycat cult just a group of psychos who lacked the imagination to come up with their own freak show? Or were they tapping into the darkness, the ancient primal force of black magic that had fueled Zagan, Amun, and Rezok's evil? Was he about to step into some black magic shitstorm? There was only one way to find out. Talon met Koska's gaze and said, When do I leave? Chapter 5. Talon's plane touched down 12 hours later in Hampton, Ohio. As always, he was traveling light, and within a half an hour of landing, he was navigating the foggy roads in his black BMW rental car. His first stop would be a local Best Western where Koska had booked a room for him. He didn't plan to waste any time. After the long, relaxing week in Florida, he was hungry for action. He located his room and found a metal case waiting for him on the freshly made bed. From experience, he knew that Koska's little care package would be filled with kit. He tapped in the proper combination, and the case snapped open, revealing a Glock, K-bar knife, night vision goggles, a Heckler & Koch machine pistol, and multiple magazines of ammo. He loaded the Glock, strapped on the knife, and decided to seek out the copycat cult's last crime scene. The authorities had found the Porsche of a missing couple in a nearby park about a mile away from where he was staying. Geared up, Talon left the hotel. It was around 6 when he set foot in the scenic playground. Red shadows bled over the playsets and trees. For the most part, the park was sparsely populated. A couple of families kept watchful eyes on their children and shot Talon suspicious glances. He couldn't blame them after what had happened here. The kids almost seemed to sense that a terrible tragedy had befallen the place. Their play seemed muted, lacking the laughter and shouts one commonly associated with children and parks. Perhaps the cold weather accounted for their lethargic behavior. A chill was settling over the area, after all. Having been spoilt by Mexico and Florida weather, Ohio's brisk days felt unpleasantly cold, though they paled in comparison with the snowy conditions he'd encountered back in Norway. The police had done a decent job washing away the vandalism, but they hadn't quite succeeded in erasing all signs of the vicious attack. It didn't take long for Talon's eyes to find the graffiti the cult had left behind. The barcode skull on the cement wall that ringed the parking lot was faded, the result of multiple attempts to scrub it off by the authorities, but a person who knew what they were searching for wouldn't have any trouble spotting it. Wary glances continued to follow him. Ignoring the attention, Talon continued to search the area. His behavior would be deemed suspicious by some of the wary parents, but hopefully wouldn't warrant a call to the police. The plan was to scan the park without overstaying his welcome.
Talon had no illusions about what he would find. He didn't think he would magically stumble upon some piece of evidence the cops had missed, but maybe there was some detail about the crime scene that would mean more to people like him and Koska than the law. The police were scoping for forensic clues. Talon was snooping for signs of the occult. He checked the surroundings and finally spotted a pentagram and an inverted cross carved into the trunks of a few nearby trees. There was another sign, too, the Greek letters Alpha and Omega, beginning and end. Talon frowned. What did it signify? He snapped pictures of the symbols and kept combing the park. Further inspection proved fruitless, and he decided to return to his hotel. As he left the park grounds, he felt one of the moms staring at him again. He winked at her, and she quickly averted her gaze. A moment later, he was gone. Talon resumed his investigation the next day. He showered, dressed, and knocked back some boiling coffee, his tongue desensitized to the point where his cup of joe needed to be volcano hot to work its magic. The Reaper and his followers had been skaters before they had added murder and Satanism to their resume. Maybe the new cult had a similar background. Talon decided to start his investigation in the East End, a wasteland dominated by empty tenements and industrial lots. According to his research, it was the place where the most radical and dangerous dudes shredded. The kids out there were mostly runaways, druggies, and burnouts. Odds were good that the copycat cult might be drawing from the same talent pool. Talon wore an old pair of sneakers, green khakis, and a hoodie. His Delta training had taught him the art of blending in with his surroundings. He hadn't shaved since Mexico and needed a haircut, which helped sell the look. No one would mistake him for some teen punk, but neither did he look like a square. He picked up a used board at Switchfoot, a skate shop he came across on his way to the East End, and parked the BMW about a quarter of a mile from his destination. He got out of the rental and skated the rest of the way. He'd been an avid skater when he was young and could still pull off a few moves. Being the son of a diplomat, Talon had lived all across the world when he was a teen. Every year seemed to bring a new city in a different country. Exploring a new place on his deck was a rite of passage, a way of making his ever-changing surroundings feel like home. Shooting down the winding road of the industrial wasteland on his board brought it all back. For a brief moment, he was able to forget the real reason why he was here. 15 minutes later, Talon reached his destination. The East End skate park lay tucked under a bridge, cars and trucks rattling by overhead. He descended a rusty staircase and walked along a chain-link fence. Before him, the whole East End spread out. The place looked trashed, the skate rink scrawled with graffiti. Skaters abounded, sporting tats, piercings, and a ton of attitude. Talon's skin prickled with a palpable aura of danger. A skater shot up a bull nearby and finished off with a 360 kickflip. The wheels snapped against the cement. His appearance was ragged and dirty, oozing a predatory quality. Borderline gutter punk. Talon approached some of the other skaters lounging around the bowls. It was an older, more hardened crowd. He offered one of the dudes a cigarette and struck up a conversation. Soon, he steered their chat toward the Reaper. His spiel was simple. He'd seen the stories on the news and wanted in. Unfortunately, the line of questioning proved to be a dead end. The kid eyed him blankly when the subject came up, almost as if he was addressing him in a foreign language, and then their chat was over. Talon continued to search for someone who might be more talkative if properly motivated. He secretly hoped that his questions might draw out a member of the copycat gang. If someone began following him or tried to start something, they'd be in for a surprise. Maybe he was being too cocky, but after dealing with Al-Qaeda, a group of skater rats didn't faze him. He wanted the bad guys to know he was looking for them. The question was, who would blink first? After a few more failed attempts and some suspicious stares here and there, he found someone who was willing to help out, for a price. "You sure you're ready to be part of this?" Carl, a 20-something shredder with long greasy hair, said. "I spent 4 years risking my life for Uncle Sam, and for what, to come home to a country where a bunch of pussy-assed, overprivileged hipster assholes have all the power?" "So you got the Lightwalker. You'll know if you're ready."
"The Lightwalker? That's what people call him," Carl said. "I don't know, man. Maybe if I had a couple more smokes, I could remember why."
Talon regarded the kid with growing curiosity. The punk flashed him a knowing grin. He might be a dropout druggie, but what he lacked in school smarts he made up for in animal cunning. He knew he possessed information that Talon wanted, and was ready to negotiate. Talon offered him a whole pack of cigarettes and his lighter. As soon as the skater pocketed the spoils, he resumed his explanation. Lightwalker walked into the light, he elaborated, revealing a row of yellow nicotine-stained teeth. Talon still stared at the skater with incomprehension. He wiped out, hit his head, died on the spot, walked down the tunnel and into the light, Carl continued. But they managed to bring him back. That's why he skates without fear now, skates like he doesn't care about living or dying. Talon didn't quite know what to make of this. Was the punk telling the truth? Lightwalker saw the light and now speaks to the dead, Carl said, exhaling a cloud of smoke. Talon blinked. What the hell are you talking about? Like that kid in the Sixth Sense. He can see ghosts, speaks with dead people. You don't want to fuck with the dude, is what I'm saying. Talon decided to risk it and said, How do I find him? Maybe he'll find you. The punk shot him a grin. Talon felt his patience running dry. He was almost ready to snatch the asshole by the collar and rub that smirk right off his face when the kid added, Word is, he stays at the old mall. Talon frowned. The kid had to be talking about the regional national mall where the final showdown between the Reaper and the police had taken place. The mall had closed shortly after the shooting and had stood abandoned ever since. It had been scheduled for demolition at one point, but the developers ran out of money. Just another victim of the recession. Be careful. If he doesn't like you, he won't let you walk out of that place. Talon waited for the kid to add something more, but apparently the conversation was now officially over, the kid preoccupied with filling his lungs with carcinogens. Talon shrugged and left the park, sensing this was as much as he would get today. The hostile glares of the other skaters trailed him, but no one actually followed. As he climbed into his rental car and drove off, Talon kept reviewing what the skater had shared with him. This Lightwalker character apparently was a near-death survivor. The weird detail sounded too crazy to just be a story the punk had made up. Lightwalker saw the light and now speaks to the dead. Something about the punk's words sent a shiver down Talon's spine. He drove back to his hotel and hit his computer. He Googled the mall and a number of photographs flashed on screen. A series of monolithic, weathered structures grew from a vast, vacant parking lot. A fading JCPenney sign with two letters missing loomed forebodingly over a graffiti-besmirched exterior. This was an urban explorer's wet dream. It would be Mecca to any freak who thought the Reaper had been some sort of hero fighting a corrupt system. Talon inspected the images of the dead mall more closely. The desolate shopping center had a post-apocalyptic quality. The large empty parking lots, coupled with the many signs of nature reclaiming the area, trees and vegetation bursting from the stretches of asphalt, stirred an uneasy feeling inside Talon. The place sure seemed like the perfect place for a nomadic band of killers to set up shop. What might be waiting for him inside the Reaper's old stomping grounds? He planned to find out. Chapter 6. Officer Robert Benson and his partner, Glenn Durham, were the first officers to receive the call about the shooting at the Regional Hall Mall. Benson swallowed the last bite of his tuna sandwich, drained his cup of Diet Coke, and surged toward their cruiser. Less than a minute later, their police car screamed down the road, sirens flashing. Within 15 minutes, he was making his way through the deadly still mall, Glenn on his side, burning up with adrenaline as he tried to maintain a steady grip on his firearm. The moment he spotted the first bodies, his heart sank. We're too late, he thought. Victim after victim, legs and arms akimbo like broken marionettes resting in widening pools of scarlet. Their empty, accusatory eyes fixed on him, blaming him for not showing up on time and failing to protect them, to keep them safe from the madman in the mall. The acrid smell of gunpowder wafted through the air. Benson flinched as the pitiful screams from the wounded mixed with staccato bursts of gunfire. And then, finally, the band of murderers grew visible. Hooded skater kids, bony hands clutching guns and knives. Benson lost it. There was zero hesitation as he squeezed the trigger. The punks went down, joining their victims on the floor. Benson rushed past their broken forms, blocking out the sight while following the desperate cries of a woman. The dead were gone, but there was still a chance to save the living. The woman's shrill voice was laced with mortal fear. He rounded the corner of the concourse and came face to face with the monster at the heart of the massacre. Schiller, also known as the Reaper, stood in the center of the food court, which had become ground zero of the mass shooting. His bony fingers clawed the hair of his female hostage. The Reaper was bald and skeletally thin with bulging eyes. He wore a ratty hoodie and baggy cargo pants that gave his bony, unnaturally tall frame a scarecrow-like appearance. The bloody sickle in his hand, combined with his death skull appearance and the pile of lifeless bodies at his feet, made Benson think he was looking at the Grim Reaper himself. Time stretched as Benson locked eyes with the mass murderer. He heard gunshots, saw his partner go down beside him. He squeezed the trigger and bullets roared from the muzzle of his firearm. Later, he'd tell reporters that he got lucky, but none of the papers would print the quote. The public needed a hero after the bloodbath. The bullets from his pistol found the Reaper, and the skeletal figure crumpled. It was done. He'd slain the beast. A sudden croaking sound made Benson look down. His partner peered up at him, his cratered head framed by a halo of red, his eyes questioning as if he wanted to know why Benson had let him die. Benson's eyes snapped open and he fought back a scream. For a long beat, he just stared at the ceiling, breathing heavily. He turned, looking almost longingly at the empty half of the king-sized bed. Ashley had left him a year after the shooting. Poor woman had tried to salvage their marriage, but he'd given her little to work with. Eventually, he shut her out to a point where there was no other choice but to make a break. Why had he pushed her away? Maybe he felt it was the only way to keep her safe, to spare her future hurt. Her side of the bed had remained empty ever since, except for a one-night stand here or there. Benson grunted, letting go of the painful memories, and got up. Stumbling into the bathroom, he wiped the thick beads of perspiration off his face and stared at his graying stubble. He was nearing his 40th birthday, and the signs of aging were everywhere. From the wrinkles crinkling his eyes to the paunch forming around his middle, time was marching on, and he'd better just hang on tight for the ride. And now, the nightmares were back. It had taken him 5 long years to put the mall shooting behind him. 3 cops had been killed that day, another 6 injured, but Benson had walked away from the carnage without a scratch. No, that wasn't quite true. His wounds were the kind that one couldn't see at first, but would manifest themselves in the weeks, months, and years to come. The incident might have led to his promotion as a detective, but also cost him a partner, his marriage, and countless sleepless nights. Now the past had caught up with him, as he always dreaded it would. Reports of the first kidnapping had given him a bad feeling. The vandalism, the graffiti, and the choice of victim, a high-earning investment banker, made Benson immediately think of the Reaper. Benson's bullets had struck down Ralph Schiller that day, but the legends surrounding the cult leader lived on. The Reaper sold newspapers and books and made people tune into their local broadcasts. Ironic that a war against hyper-capitalism would give rise to a cottage industry designed to cash in on his notoriety. Benson was surprised they hadn't turned his story into a goddamn TV movie yet. Maybe there were too many freaks vying for the public's attention. With the help of a dark charisma and a hate-filled ideology born from economic inequality, the Reaper had gathered skaters, runaways, and taggers around himself like some urban Pied Piper. He'd weaponized them with poisonous philosophy directed at anyone who supported capitalist America. A modern Manson. The attack on the mall had been the group's final statement, the last in a string of violent crimes. At least Benson thought it was the last. Benson showered, dressed, and headed for the precinct. He was relieved to discover that no new kidnappings had been reported. He decided to catch up on the paperwork that was piling up. He wasn't actively investigating the new crimes, and his attention was needed elsewhere. Nevertheless, for the rest of the day, Benson's mind kept returning to his nightmare. He hadn't been back to the old mall in years. He wondered if his subconscious had dredged up the memory for a reason. If a copycat gang roamed the city, what better place to hole up than the old mall? The mere idea made Benson crave a drink. Almost as if his colleagues could read his thoughts, they invited him to join them at a local watering hole after work. Benson generally avoided bars when he could and tried to stay away from the bottle. Shit was bad enough without booze in his life. Once he started, it would be too hard to stop. Better to just head home and watch some TV before calling it an early night. Betraying his intentions, he turned on Grand Avenue instead of going straight home. As he drove toward the mall, he navigated a number of vacant parking lots and rows of tract homes. The cookie-cutter buildings appeared deserted, the windows dark and boarded up. Foreclosure signs alternated with garages tagged with graffiti. The area was a ghost town. 20 minutes later, he pulled into the abandoned parking lot of the Regional National Mall. The fading sunlight played over the surface of the decrepit structure, a sprawling monument to suburban decay. It made Benson think of a shipwreck rotting away at the bottom of the ocean floor. Forgotten by most, only living on in the nightmares of the shooting survivors. What are you doing here? There had been a time when the mall and its parking lot attracted runaways, prostitutes, and drug dealers. But soon word spread that the mall was haunted, that the Reaper's victims still lingered within its labyrinthine walls. These weren't merely tall tales. People who'd ventured into the mall to get high or engage in other shady activities disappeared. One year, the department combed the place and found the bodies of 15 people who'd sought refuge inside the shopping center during the bitter winter months. The official story was they froze to death, but word on the street was that the restless ghost of the Reaper had snatched them. Nowadays, no one came here except a few teens on occasion, and they were smart enough to not venture beyond the relative safety of the sprawling parking lot. Benson hadn't been here since that fateful day, but the mall had lived on in his memories. Seeing it with his own eyes after all this time made him feel numb. He opened his car door and threw up his lunch. Steaming piles of half-digested food hit the overgrown lot. The shadows lengthened, and for a wild moment he thought he spotted the hooded outline of the Reaper in the near distance. The wind outside was bitter, and it was getting late. Tomorrow he might return with some men and search the area, but Benson would make sure not to be among the detectives entering the cursed place. He closed the car door and took off. The tires screamed and left tread marks in the deserted lot. He wasn't ashamed to admit that the mall terrified him. He drove 20 miles above the speed limit all the way to his home. Stealing nervous glances around the dark neighborhood, he entered his 2-bedroom house. As soon as he was inside, he made sure to double bolt and lock the door. He couldn't shake the irrational sensation that an invisible stalker had followed him all the way from the mall. He headed for the kitchen, located the bottle of bourbon he kept stashed in a cupboard behind the fridge, and poured himself a double. He drained the drink and let out a cough. Hard liquor wasn't his poison of choice anymore. When had he bought the bottle? Must have been around New Year's Eve, 11 months earlier. He turned up the TV, suddenly needing to hear human voices, and soon the effects of the alcohol washed over him. Fear still held him in its grip, but the booze was taking the edge off his emotions, dulling them somewhat. Feeling a bit dizzy, he headed into the bathroom and splashed some water on his face. When he looked up, a hooded skater punk stared back at him. Before he could scream or turn on the intruder, the taser's 50,000 volts rippled through his body. Benson hit the floor in a twitching mass. Chapter 7. Night had fallen, and a thick fog shrouded the crumbling Regional National Mall. Talon lurked among a row of trees that faced the sprawling wasteland of the mall's lot. In addition to the K-bar strapped around his leg and the Glock in his holster, the Heckler & Koch machine pistol hung on a strap from his shoulder. He was garbed in skin-tight combat black and perfectly blended in with the nocturnal landscape. The spectral green of his night-vision binoculars revealed no sign of life. This desolate temple of capitalism remained forgotten by the world at large. Talon zoomed in on the entrance of Sears. The tinted glass of the doors gave no hint at what might be going on inside the immense structure. There was no way around it. He'd have to enter the mall to determine if the copycat cult had found sanctuary within its decaying walls. For a moment, he debated if he should hold off his inspection until the morning, but if the enemy were here, he would be active at night. There was a prickly sensation in his neck and a sensation of ice in his gut. Shivers tracked the length of his spine. He couldn't shake the pervasive feeling that he was being watched. Talon slipped the binoculars into his backpack and dashed across the deserted parking lot. His boots made no sound as he flitted toward the 3-story structure. Cloying condensation wrapped around him. The fog was growing heavier by the second. Moments later, he reached the department store's doors. All of them were locked. He removed a lockpick and went to work. Within minutes, the door gave way to his concentrated efforts, and he slipped into the Sears. He donned his night vision goggles, and ghostly green light drenched the store. A landscape of empty racks, shopping carts, and mannequins confronted him. The place was as silent as a tomb. Talon inhaled the musty air and advanced deeper into the structure. He crossed the main floor and found an arched entrance that led to the mall's main concourse. Moonlight shafted down skylights that pierced the length of the large hallway. The mall boasted two more floors with balconies running along the upper levels. Picking up his pace until he was moving at a light sprint, he passed rows of caged-up shops and restaurants that had long ago gone out of business. His senses became attuned to his environment, probing the yawning darkness for any signs that he might not be alone. All throughout, his fingers never wavered from the trigger of his machine pistol, its steel barrel leading the way. He followed the moonlight. Based on maps and floor plans he'd checked out earlier online, he was headed for the main plaza of the mall where the food court was located. So far, it appeared as though no one had set foot in this place for ages, but Talon knew better than most that appearances could be deceiving. The Forsaken Mall stirred strange emotions inside of him. He had a soft spot for malls. Even though he'd traveled the world as a kid, his father had made sure to let him spend his summers in the States with his uncle. He might not have been able to offer him a traditional American childhood, but he wanted Talon to have a taste of what life back home felt like, at least for a few months out of the year. Most days, his uncle, who worked security at a local museum, would drop Talon off at an air-conditioned mall in the morning and pick him up at the end of the day after work. He'd spent much of his summers roaming the local shopping center, catching movies in the multiplex, reading comics off the rack at Walden Books, and flirting with girls in the food court. Ever since then, malls had symbolized a slice of Americana that made him feel at home no matter where he was. It made him unaccountably sad to see this one desolate and abandoned. He stepped up to a pair of escalators fronted by overturned potted artificial trees. Taking two steps at a time, he scaled the escalator, hoping the high-angle view on the second level might offer a better overview of the terrain. He continued his advance, passing more gated boutiques. He also encountered signs that the mall hadn't been completely uninhabited for the last few years. Graffiti scarred the walls and storefronts, and detritus littered the ground. Discarded fast-food wrappings and empty bottles of liquor abounded. Guard up, Talon slowed his approach. Shapes were becoming visible in the plaza below him. He wasn't alone any longer. A ring of spooky human silhouettes formed a large circle around a cement island. A lone figure stood at the top of the island and overlooked the crowd. Talon slipped off his goggles. There was enough moonlight here to follow the action without any technological assistance. Narrowing his gaze, he counted about 25 hooded figures in the circle. The man they faced was decked out all in ghostly white, and they kept a reverent distance from him. He had to be the leader of the group, the Lightwalker. He can speak with the dead. Talon crept closer to the circle, hoping to gain a better view, his machine pistol ready. He was right above the gathering now and realized that there was another man he hadn't noticed before. This figure didn't sport a hoodie, but was dressed in slacks and a button shirt. He appeared disoriented and isolated, crouched on his knees, positioned between the crowd of followers and the white-garbed leader on the cement island. A prisoner. Talon realized. Now that he hovered directly over the unholy congregation, he saw that the leader wore a spray painter's mask. His white attire formed a sharp contrast to the dark clothing of the cultists. The moonlight played over the white hoodie and cargo pants, heightening the spectral effect. The other followers all sported curved blades. Sickles. Was it a way to honor the legacy of the Reaper? Talon gripped his Heckler and Coke a little harder. Below him, the Lightwalker spoke. Death is only the beginning. What happened next proved that these weren't mere empty words. Chapter 8. It took Detective Benson less than a minute to figure out what was happening after he regained consciousness. One look at his surroundings told him everything he needed to know. He was back inside the regional mall. He couldn't see the eyes of his hooded captors, but he spotted their shiny blades. To his surprise, a strange calm had fallen over him. He knew what would happen next, and at some level he even welcomed the confrontation with terror that had haunted him for 5 years. One way or another, he wouldn't have to live with the fear any longer. A figure appeared on the cement island that once had sprouted trees and plants. For a second, the old terror gripped him as he wondered if the Reaper had returned from the grave. He let the moment pass. Schiller was long gone from this world. This had to be the man in charge of the copycat cult. The leader in the white hoodie loomed before him like some spectral post-apocalyptic warrior monk. The figure was about 6 feet tall and athletically built. Definitely not Schiller, then. Benson tried to catch a better look at the face under the hood, but it remained shrouded in mystery. A spray painter's mask hid all the details of his features, heightening his larger-than-life persona. The cult leader approached Benson.
"You know why you're here," he said.
Benson remained silent. The cult leader turned his attention away from him and addressed the crowd.
4 years ago, this man took the life of someone who wanted to change the world we live in. A man who was brave enough to hold up a mirror to society and show them what this country had become. He told the truth, and it cost him the ultimate price. This man you see before you was the one who pulled the trigger. This is the pig who shot the Reaper.
Schiller was scum, Benson hissed under his breath, just like the rest of you.
Benson's words reverberated in the cavernous plaza, adding to the impression that he was standing at the center of an ancient temple.
And I'm about to be the sacrifice, he thought.
You think you won that day, but Schiller never left you, did he? He stayed with you, haunting your every moment, cursing you.
It was as if the bastard could read his mind, knew all his secrets. Who the fuck was this guy? The cult leader took another step toward him.
Come on, just a little closer.
Not everything that dies disappears from our world. Sometimes the dead linger, unwilling to pass into the light because their life's work remains undone.
What the hell was this asshole jabbering about?
Can't you feel it? Our master is here with you right now. Schiller's flesh succumbed to your bullets, but his spirit remains right here, watching, waiting to punish you for what you did that day.
The cult leader paused dramatically and added,
Death is only the beginning.
The crowd of hoodies echoed his words, the chorus of their voices bouncing off the walls like an unholy prayer.
Death is only the beginning. Master, take his life the way he took yours,
the leader said. Terror gripped Benson. He could feel the atmosphere change, a chill falling over the plaza. The burst of frigid air made him want to wrap his arms around his torso, but he couldn't allow himself to show any weakness. For a crazed beat, he wondered if Schiller's spirit could truly linger. Benson's rational mind tried to discard the notion, but the superstitious part of his soul knew the cult leader was telling the truth. The realization made his body turn rigid with atavistic fear. The Reaper is here. Shaking off his growing terror, Benson willed his thoughts to focus on his predicament. Three hoodies were closing in, sickles out. The wheels of their skateboards crunched over the trash-covered plaza. Perhaps Schiller's spirit still lingered, but these knife-wielding gutter rats were flesh and blood, and that meant he could fight back. Willing himself to remain patient, Benson waited until they were almost upon him. The first hoodie rolled forward on his skateboard, moonlight dancing over the knife in one hand and the canister of spray paint in the other. Benson pretended to be paralyzed with fear, which wasn't all that far from the truth. He waited and waited. The knife slid into his field of vision, and that's when he made his move. Without warning, his right leg swept out, catching the incoming hoodie off guard. He'd clearly expected the middle-aged cop to offer little resistance. An instant later, the punk was on the ground with Benson pinning him down. The knife clattered to the floor and was lost in the encroaching shadows. Benson experienced an undeniable rush as his fist shot out and whipped the punk's head back. Before the hoodie or his friends quite knew what was happening, Benson snatched the can of spray paint the skater had dropped when he hit the floor. Lightning fast, he unloaded it at a second skater's face. There was a hiss of aerosol as a stream of blinding paint engulfed the cultist's face. Stunned by the counterattack, the skater reeled backward, giving Benson a chance to stagger to his feet. The skater let out a howl of rage and charged, his face streaked red, a demon from hell. Benson sidestepped the punk and brought up the hoodie's skateboard. Tapping into all his strength, he drove the deck down on the cultist's scarlet face. The head and board connected with a sickening crunch that was followed by the thump of the punk hitting the ground. Reacting on pure instinct, Benson ran down the dark concourse, unsteady legs barely able to support his 200-pound frame, leaving the circle of hooded wraiths in his wake. He wasn't going down without a fight, that much was for certain. He stole a glance back and saw more members of the psycho skater gang separate from the crowd and shoot after him in dark formation. Shadows pinballed through the mall at breakneck speed, phantom figures who sported steel that was all too real. Benson's legs kept pumping away as the boarded-up, gated stores rushed past him. Behind him, the urban wraiths ripped around empty water fountains and derelict kiosks. Skating with near-supernatural grace and agility, they slalomed through the mall's obstacle course, matching his pace, never letting up. Benson was doing his best to shake his pursuers, but he knew it was merely a matter of time before they would catch up with him. He was running for his life. Breathing hard, he rounded a corner. Didn't get far before another skater appeared in front of him, cutting off his escape. As the skaters closed in, Benson rushed toward a nearby escalator. He powered up the stairs as fast as his body allowed him to. His plan was simple. He had to reach one of the exits inside the department stores at either end of the mall. If he could make it out of the Mammoth Shopping Center, he might lose the cultists in the parking lot or the trees beyond. It was a long shot, but what choice did he have? As he reached the second level, he was confronted with more shuttered stores. The mall had transformed into one giant haunted house. Benson exhaled, and his breath clouded before him. Once again, he experienced the unnatural chill, as if he'd walked into a freezer. He took a few steps back, adrenaline pumping as the shadows separated and a bone-white figure lurched from the liquid darkness. Time froze as his eyes locked on the apparition. Bloodshot eyes peered back from a blue-veined face straight out of Benson's nightmares. The Reaper was back. A gaping bullet hole formed a third eye on his forehead where Benson's bullet had felled the mass murderer.
"Not everything that dies disappears from our world. Sometimes the dead linger."
Benson reeled, his blood turning to ice. "No," he cried. His voice was a glassy whisper as the Reaper's spirit advanced with jerky, surreal speed. The figure shimmered and vibrated and was suddenly upon him, inches separating them. Terror-stricken, Benson recoiled and hit the balcony. Arms wheeling desperately, he pitched over the railing. The ground rushed up as he plunged head first toward the floor. But the deadly collision of bone and cement never came. Seconds before impact, Benson froze in midair. An invisible force clamped around his ankle, the nerve endings of his skin lighting up with fiery pain. The air crackled with energy, and then he was being pulled up, faster and faster. The force flung him aside like a rag doll, and he landed hard on the second-floor balcony. It was a brief reprieve as two hoodies lurched toward him, murder in their eyes. Benson was spent, no strength left in him. He bowed his head and awaited his fate. Red dots found the two hoodies, and their chests erupted with a burst of gunfire. The cultists collapsed. Weakly, Benson craned his neck toward his savior. A man garbed in black emerged from the shadows, machine pistol up and ready, night vision goggles giving him an insectile quality. One gloved hand reached for him while the other fired a burst of rounds at three more incoming skaters. The hoodies went down in the darkness. Benson allowed himself to be pulled to his feet, and a beat later they were moving down the concourse, the cultists hot on their tails. But the detective didn't worry about the men rushing after them. All he could think about was the inhuman face of the Reaper. Benson sensed that, despite the arrival of the armed stranger, there would be no escape from the cursed mall. Chapter 9. Talon depressed his finger on the trigger and fed lead into the fast-approaching cultists. Two hooded figures crumpled in a mist of red. Talon whirled toward the downed man who'd barely escaped death mere seconds earlier. He still didn't quite understand what he'd just witnessed. The man had gone off the balcony and should have fallen to his death, but some strange force had pulled him back into the air, halting his deadly descent. Fear of the unknown gave way to the immediate pressure of the situation. More cultists were zeroing in on their position. Talon's combat-hardened instincts took over, and he lifted the man to his feet. Seconds later, they were surging down the concourse, the previously sepulchral silence replaced with shouts, hissing spray canisters, and the wheels of skateboards rippling over cement. Talon kept firing into the darkness, the grunts and moans telling him that his bullets had found mortal enemies. Up ahead, J.C. Penney loomed into view, and they tore into the dark department store, Talon's night vision mapping the way. A creepy landscape of junk and dust-caked mannequins awaited them. At the center of the empty store, Talon made out a group of mattresses. There were backpacks, wrappers of junk food, the walls tattooed with graffiti. The barcode skull dominated the tags, No surprise there. Talon guessed this was where the skaters dwelled when they weren't kidnapping their victims and hunting them through the mall's endless hallways. What power could the Lightwalker wield to control so many people? To organize these lost souls living on the edge of society into a de facto army of murderers? A terrible stench of decay interrupted his thoughts. Judging from the expression of disgust on the other man's face, he'd picked it up too. Death was in the air. Talon followed the stomach-turning odor, brushed through a row of racks and empty boxes, and froze. 9 rotting bodies lined the floor, empty eyes turned toward the ceiling. The missing kidnapping victims. The old rage boiled up inside Talon, and his heart grew cold. It took all his self-control not to dash back into the mall and take out the rest of these psychopathic bastards. There was a sudden sound to his right, and Talon whirled, eyes focusing on 3 eerie mannequins. His companion fixed him with a haunted stare. "We can't outrun the dead," he muttered. "What are you talking about?" "The Reaper's here. I shot him, but he's still here. He's never left this place. All these years he's been waiting for me. He won't let me leave." Almost as if to lend credence to the panicked man's words, Talon's breath misted in the sudden cold. It was as if someone had cranked the AC all the way up. For a split second, he was reminded of the terrible cold he'd experienced back in Norway when he had confronted the wrath of the Winter Warlock. "We're both getting out of here. Now." Talon shifted his gaze toward the exit, but now found a row of mannequins blocking their path. He could have sworn the area was clear mere seconds earlier. Without warning, one of the mannequins moved, a lifeless arm lashing out at him. Talon fired, bullets shredding the mannequin, sending plaster limbs flying. His pulse quickened as he crouched before the bullet-riddled dummy. Did he imagine the movement after all? "Oh my God, he's here. The Reaper's here." Talon spun toward the panicked man, and that's when he saw the apparition. It lasted for only a blink of an eye, more like an optical illusion than anything else. A white, misty silhouette stood outlined about 30 feet from them. There was a jerk, almost like a jump cut in reality, and then the same figure loomed before them. Talon brought up his machine pistol, but the barrel was pointed at thin air, the specter having vanished once more. A hiss of a spray canister made Talon whirl. Where was it coming from? He didn't spot the canister, but he saw the graffiti bleeding over the floor. 2 Greek letters, Alpha and Omega, beginning and end. Death is only the beginning. "Go. Get out of here. Save yourself before it's too—" The words were cut off as an invisible force twisted the man's arm. Bones snapped and he exhaled in pain. He slumped to his knees, gasping. There was no time to recuperate from the spectral attack as the entity pounded his face into the ground with savage force, again and again. Talon shot toward the twitching, groaning man. He had crossed less than half the distance when a force lifted Talon into the air and tossed him aside. Talon slammed into a row of metal clothing racks and collapsed on the floor. He lay there groggy as the spectral attack intensified against the stranger. The force yanked him backward, bending his spine unnaturally before dragging his whole body along the floor at breakneck speed, up the wall and along the ceiling. For a split second, the man remained suspended on the ceiling before his lifeless body came crashing down right before Talon's feet. Despite his training and years of combat, terror seized him. The former Delta operator had seen many a man die in front of him, but he had never experienced anything like this. The air crackled and hissed with electricity, making Talon's hair stand on end. Energy filled the abandoned department store. The man he had failed to save claimed the Reaper's spirit haunted this mall, and now Talon believed him. But how to fight an enemy he couldn't even see? Before Talon could process the horror, an invisible force that had destroyed his companion reached out for him. A violent burst of energy shredded his combat suit, and black marks burned over his skin. The contact with the strange force took his breath away. He gasped in agony and dropped the machine pistol, which clattered ineffectively over the floor. A boneless face materialized, bloodshot eyes squirming with hatred. The Reaper's presence was upon him. The entity lifted Talon upward and pinned him against the wall like a puny insect. There was pressure against his diaphragm and he couldn't breathe. He was about to share the broken, bloodied man's fate. The Reaper's skeletal features grew visible, lips dried with blood, eyes pools of pure blackness. not flesh, but made of an unstable, translucent material, constantly reforming, exposing muscles as the thin membrane shifted and shredded. A hand reached out for Talon's chest, bony fingers vanishing inside his ribcage like spectral scalpels. He could almost visualize those fingers closing around his hammering heart, intent on squeezing the life right out of him. No, it couldn't end like this. Talon stared into the Reaper's inhuman eyes. The spirit had become death itself, living up to his namesake. There was a sensation of heat, and his pentacle amulet lit up, responding to the proximity of the supernatural being. Crackling energy ignited the air, and the Reaper recoiled, dispersing as it unleashed a bone-rattling, inhuman shriek. Talon tilted forward, nothing holding him aloft any longer, and tumbled back to the ground. He gasped, coughing up blood. Nearby, the spirit of the Reaper was reforming, filaments of concentrated light hanging in midair as the spooky wisps coalesced back into the shape of a man. Talon had no idea if the amulet would save him one more time. The Reaper wasn't like any enemy he'd ever faced before. Driven by his desire to live, Talon staggered to his feet and stumbled for the exit. Renewed bursts of energy erupted, still struggling to take shape and reach out for him, but he blocked it from his mind. His complete focus was on the arched exit ahead. Unloading a clip into the lock, he ran full bore toward the door. Talon didn't know much about spirit beings like the Reaper, but among the whispered legends and half-forgotten lore, one detail stuck out. Ghosts were often bound to the place of their death. Maybe, just maybe, the Reaper wouldn't be able to follow him beyond the walls of his retail tomb. A final roar of bestial frustration accompanied his escape, and then Talon was alone, sprinting across the parking lot. He hated to retreat, leaving the bodies of the fallen behind wasn't his style either, but nothing would be gained if he faced the Reaper and allowed himself to become just another rotting corpse in the mall. He would strategize with Casca and return to face this entity, if there was a way to defeat a ghost. Moments later, he reached his rental car and kicked open the hinged door, still unwilling to hazard a glance behind him, praying the entity wasn't following him. He sucked in sharp mouthfuls of air, fired up the ignition, and tapped the accelerator. Only once the regional mall had receded in his rearview mirror did his hands stop shaking. A half an hour later, a battered Talon used his keycard to let himself into his hotel room. One of the reasons he avoided five-star hotels, even though Casca could afford them, was that the cheaper, more rundown places offered more privacy. People knew to keep to themselves. Not having to trudge past a reception desk to get to your room didn't hurt either. In his current beaten-up state, he would have drawn plenty of raised eyebrows. He staggered into the bathroom, flipped on the light switch, and stepped up to the mirror to assess the full extent of the damage. His skin-tight black sweater had been shredded by the spectral attack, and the skin underneath felt bruised and sensitive. His chest burned as he pulled off the shirt. He tossed the ruined garment on the floor and inspected the twin black marks that ran down his pectoral muscles in long, fat lines. The new injuries framed the inverted pentagram scars Agen had carved into his skin back in San Francisco. The wounds resembled electrical burns of some kind. Making matters worse, his stab wound was bleeding again, too. "I'm falling apart here," Talon thought. He shouldn't be complaining. At least he was alive. The same couldn't be said for the man he'd failed to save back in the mall. "I shot him, but he never left this place." Talon considered the dead man's words and concluded he must have been one of the cops who put a stop to the Reaper's wanton massacre 5 years earlier. Talon rubbed an anti-burn salve on his fresh wounds and bit his lips. The cream stung like crazy. He wrapped his chest in gauze and swallowed a few painkillers. He'd faced demons and cults, but he'd never confronted a ghost before. His amulet had saved his ass, but he was in dire need of a different kind of weapon and a new strategy if he was to face the Lightwalker and his spectral master again. He can speak to the dead. What did it all mean? Was this cult leader controlling the Reaper's spirit somehow? Casca would no doubt have some ideas on the matter. Talon staggered to the small desk which fronted the bed and switched on his laptop. A Google search produced a piece on the Reaper. A photo of a familiar face confronted Talon, the police officer he'd left behind at the mall. His name had been Officer Rob Benson, one of the first officers to arrive on the scene. Over the years, Talon had walked into enough combat zones to know the kind of horror Benson must have encountered on that horrific day. After his partner was hit, Benson drew fire. 4 bullets cut down the Reaper. Many of the followers lost heart after their leader went down. Who knows how many more innocent lives would have perished if not for Benson. The man deserved every commendation he had earned that day. Talon also knew Benson probably didn't even see himself as a hero. Like soldiers, victories lost their luster when it came at such a high price. Benson had stopped the Reaper, but he had failed his partner. Talon logged off the website and clenched his teeth. A good man had perished today, just another casualty in this war against the darkness. He vowed to do everything in his power to stop the Reaper and his new killer cult, but how to defeat a ghost? The weapons he'd mastered over his military career were useless against the spirits of the dead. It was time to call Casca. Even though it had to be 2 o'clock on the West Coast, the billionaire sounded bright and alert when he answered the phone. Was some pretty new conquest keeping Casca up this late, or were the man's demons denying him a much-needed rest? Either way, Casca was awake, and Talon was glad for it. In a voice drained of all emotion, he asked, "So, Casca, do you believe in ghosts?"
Chapter 10. The scenic drive through the untamed canyons and folds of the Santa Ana foothills almost made Dr. Adira Austin forget the grim reason that brought her out here today. 5 weeks earlier, Air Blue Flight 191, headed from Las Vegas to Los Angeles, had gone down when the plane slammed into a cloud-covered mountain ridge. All 162 passengers and crew perished that day. At 29, Adira was the youngest parapsychologist working at the Nexus Foundation, and her objective was to scan the crash site for signs of survival. Not survival in the traditional sense. The bodies of everyone on board the flight had long been cleared from the debris field. She was searching for evidence that human consciousness could survive after death. She was hunting for ghosts. In the past, most of Nexus's research had focused on the study of reincarnation and near-death experiences, where subjects could be interviewed and records compared. Investigating hauntings and apparitions had been beyond their reach until recently. Ghosts were far harder to measure and quantify, but scientific breakthroughs, helped along by the generous backing they were receiving from their billionaire benefactor Simon Casca, had supercharged the investigative tools at their disposal. To Adira's mind, it wasn't a question whether ghosts existed. She'd barely survived a haunting when she was a teenager and knew that spirits were all too real. Her hope nowadays was to produce scientific proof that would convince the rest of the world. The jeep she was traveling in slowed, and Adira knew they would soon reach their destination. There were no throngs of onlookers, no signs of news vans or satellite trucks anymore. After a month, both the media vultures and the world had moved on, busy reporting on newer, more pressing horrors. The jeep rumbled up the tire-eating dirt lane, crested a peak, and reached the top of the hill that overlooked the site where the plane had gone down in a giant fireball. A chill rippled up her spine as she took in the gouged black earth before her. A section of the forested hillside had been decimated by the vast explosion. Death permeated the air. In her mind's eye, Adira visualized a debris field of twisted wreckage, smoking fuselage and scattered luggage. But the area had mercifully been cleared. The barren stretch of land was the only reminder of what had happened here. The place felt like a graveyard. 162 souls had blinked out in the prime of their lives in a terrifying flash of disintegrating metal. There had been no time to prepare for death. This raised a question. Had some of the passengers failed to cross over into the afterlife? Nexus was hoping Adira would find the answer. The Foundation was targeting areas where sudden deaths had occurred, as these psychic hotspots shared a higher likelihood of producing spectral activity. The head of the Nexus Foundation, Dr. Richard Mason, was a quantum physicist with a keen interest in the paranormal, and one of the smartest men she'd ever met. He believed that there were two worlds, the world of the living and the world of the dead. Sometimes they overlapped. His words echoed in her mind as she studied the site.
"If, when we die, our memories, fears, feelings of bitterness and vengefulness are too strong, we can become earthbound. Trapped. Once separated from our bodies, consciousness might grow clouded. There is no difference between a day and 100 years in this state. Some of us will be doomed to live out our last moments over and over again, tied to the place where we died, not even aware that we're dead."
She remembered the chill she had felt after those words. The theory was terrifying. Death, like birth, might be an imperfect process. Sometimes consciousness, souls, if you will, failed to phase into the next world and became trapped in our plane of existence. Did anyone still linger in the mountain clearing? That was for her to find out. The driver parked the jeep and Adira got out. She climbed a grassy shoulder which offered a better view of the immense wasteland that stretched out before her. Dry, gnarled vines and trees framed the black swath that had been carved into the earth. A few lonely crosses and wreaths of flowers left by family and friends of the survivors served as the only sad reminders of the lives lost here. Adira fought back the shiver of apprehension crawling down her spine. The symbols of grief stirred memories she'd rather not dwell on. Personal loss had driven her into the field of parapsychology, a need to come to terms with the ghosts of her past that still, well, haunted her. Taking in the fallow land, she couldn't help but think of how horrific the scene must have been for the first responders and rescue workers when they initially approached the broken plain. According to reports, black smoke pouring from the fuselage had risen a mile into the sky, a funeral pyre for those killed in the crash. Adira eyed her two assistants. Chan was Japanese-American, in his mid-20s, and an amateur bodybuilder, his bulging muscles straining under his t-shirt. Steve fit the cliché of a paranormal investigator a little more. Pasty and overweight, the 32-year-old man possessed an open mind, yet had a precise steel-trap intellect and was willing to apply the scientific method to the unexplainable. Both men also crushed on her hard, but she felt flattered instead of creeped out by their protective attention. Chan scanned the area with an EMF reader designed to pick up fluctuations in the electromagnetic field. The presence of spirits could produce spikes. This was Ghost Hunting 101. The EMF readings were more of a warm-up exercise. The Nexus Foundation had developed new technology that made these old ways of measuring paranormal activity feel almost quaint. Adira nodded at Steve. "Let's do it." Steve lowered the metal case he was carrying to the ground. He snapped open a latch and removed a sleek electronic device from the foam lining it. It was shaped like a black motorcycle helmet. He eyed the gadget almost lovingly before handing it to Adira. He sure was attached to his toys.
"Don't worry, I'll let you take a peek when I'm done."
A smile lit up Steve's face. She slipped on the helmet and tapped a button located on the left side below her ear. An electronic view screen filled her field of vision as the paraspectral visualization system came online, painting the crash area in a reddish light. Steve proceeded to link an iPad with the helmet. Everything the microcams inside the helmet's goggles recorded was now being relayed to the tablet, allowing her assistants to follow the action in real time. The typical human eye could only pick up a limited percentage of the light spectrum. It responded to wavelengths of about 390 to 700 nanometers. Anything beyond that, like ultraviolet and X-rays, remained invisible. The Necro helmet was designed to make up for these physical limitations. Spooks could materialize to regular people for brief moments, while those with greater sensitivity to the paranormal, like psychics, could somehow tune into these frequencies in a natural way. The paraspectral goggles and speakers were designed to enhance the visual and auditory range so that a normal human would be able to see and hear ghosts the way a psychic did. "The helmet is online and ready to go," Adira said, and began to walk across the vast field. Her hands were trembling, yet somehow she managed to take one step after another. This latest research project was another stepping stone toward fulfilling Dr. Mason's vision. He wanted to eventually form a strike team that would not only help lost souls move on, but also hunt down dangerous entities. What had once been a crazy pipe dream was becoming more and more a potential reality with Casca's financial support. How the man planned to profit from their findings or even recoup his investment was beyond her. The reason she was here today wasn't to gather evidence that ghosts were real. What the Foundation hoped to achieve was to develop a way to help these lost, trapped souls successfully make the transition into the next world. Adira grew still as a flicker of static slashed over the helmet's view screen. It was followed by movement near the edge of the dense trees that framed the field. Reality shifted as more static frizzed. Adira swallowed hard and her nails dug into her palms. She wasn't alone any longer. Some poor spirit lingered in this place of death. Without her help, how long would the entity remain trapped here? The crash site was isolated. It could take years, decades, maybe even centuries before the ghost would grasp the nature of its predicament. The possibility made her shudder again. A creepy silhouette materialized from behind the row of crosses, as revealed by the crimson tint of the necrohelmet. Adira stared, mesmerized by the horror of the situation. She wanted to back away, but her legs wouldn't obey her. She was frozen in place. The figure burst toward her in jerky jumps. It was an outline of a man. His features and body remained blurry, almost as if he was vibrating at some higher frequency. There was something both human and utterly alien about the apparition on the helmet's viewscreen. Pure energy willed into human shape by a mind incapable of letting go of the memory of once having been alive. A keening sound crackled over the helmet's audio system. Words emerged from the sea of static and goosebumps exploded over her skin.
Where am I?
The words faded in and out, but kept repeating like some broken transmission that was reaching her across time and space from between worlds. Over and over again, the question repeated, fueled by mad desperation.
Where am I? Where am I?
Demanding an answer, voice rising into a shriek, the apparition lurched toward her, instinctively sensing that she could perceive its presence. Adira tasted salt and realized she was crying under the helmet. Part of her wanted to scream out, "You're dead. The plane crashed. You must let go." There was a strange, wobbling distortion of reality, and then the figure was gone. A chill settled over her as something reached for her from behind. She spun, the entity now right in front of her.
Who the hell are you?
She killed the audio and tore off the helmet, unable to continue. Her surroundings returned to normal. There was no sign that the specter was present except for a lingering cold sensation. Adira gasped for air, suddenly finding it hard to breathe. Tears were streaming down her face as the sun burned down on the desolate field. The crosses and flowers loomed before her in the dry heat. She thought she could handle it, that she could face a ghost again.
"Are you okay, Doc?"
She nodded at Steve. Both he and Chan eyed her with concern.
"I'll be fine,"
she assured them. They didn't seem convinced. Even to her own ears, her hollow voice lacked conviction.
"What do we do? How do you tell someone they're dead?
A degree in psychology never covered that one." She managed a weak smile, hoping to lighten the situation.
"There's something else," Steve said. "I have a call for you. Dr. Mason wants us to head back immediately."
"What? We can't leave him like this."
She gestured to where the specter had been moments before. Steve handed her the phone.
"You better tell him that yourself."
She gathered her thoughts. Regaining her composure somewhat, snatched the phone and said,
"Dr. Mason, what's going on?"
"Adira, you need to come back now."
Her hands were shaking, this time with rage.
"Listen, there is something, someone, out here who needs help, but it'll take some time. I just managed to establish contact."
"I'm sorry, but it will have to wait. I need you and your team to call off your current investigation. We have a far bigger problem."
"What are you talking about?"
"I'd rather not explain it over the phone. Let's just say our benefactor needs us."
To Adira's mind, the purpose and mission of Nexus wasn't to serve the private whims of some billionaire. Simon Koska was signing the checks these days, and she should have known that the money would come with strings attached.
"We're still in phase one of the Spirit Breaker program,"
Dr. Mason said.
"We'll figure this out and return to the crash site. You'll get another chance."
Another chance was fine, but would she be able to go through with it again? The sight of the ghost had struck a primal chord of terror in her. She'd chosen this path to exorcise the past, but now she wondered if she might have made a terrible mistake. Maybe she wasn't cut out for field work.
"Mason, I saw something, and I think it will haunt me for the rest of my life unless I face it right now."
She broke off, strangled by emotion.
"I'm sorry, but I need you and your team to head to Ampton, Ohio right now."
This caught her off guard.
"What's in Ohio?"
"I'll send you more information to review on your flight. Get your mind straight. I'll need you to be on your A-game out there."
The line went dead. Adira sighed. Dr. Mason was a brilliant man, but he demanded a lot from the people he trusted and respected enough to be part of the Spirit Breaker program. She was still reeling from the phone call. Mason had sounded almost afraid. What could possibly be waiting for them that could frighten even the great Dr. Mason?
What's going on? Steve asked.
He wants us to head for Ohio.
What?
My thoughts exactly. Some sort of emergency, she said and shrugged. Let's pack up the gear.
She soaked in the clearing one last time before she turned toward the jeep.
What about the...
Chan said. She merely shook her head. She peered out at the field where she knew the spirit lurked.
I'm sorry, but we'll be back.
No matter what might await her in Ohio, she intended to keep her promise at all costs.
Chapter 11.
Simon Koska had first heard about the Nexus Foundation a year earlier when he'd attended the annual convention of the Parapsychological Association. The event was held at the University of Greenwich in London every July as scientists and scholars from around the world gathered for 3 days of paper presentations, workshops, and panel discussions on the latest research into psi and related phenomena. Topics such as extrasensory perception, psychokinesis, psychic healing, altered states of consciousness, mediumship, and possible survival of bodily death were all on the program. After a long day of lectures, Koska had tried to unwind at a local pub near the university. While sipping on a pint while reviewing the seminars of the day, Dr. Mason approached him. The man was 65, lean with an energetic demeanor, hyper-intelligent eyes, and a roguish smile. He had introduced himself as a quantum physicist with an almost obsessive interest in the supernatural. Koska liked him immediately. Mason had made a joke about one of the more tedious lecturers, implying the man shouldn't discuss ghosts in a tone of voice that would even bore the dead, before diving right into his pitch. Mason had a vision that would change parapsychology and catapult psychic research into the 21st century. He had ideas, access to talent, and was sitting on a few prototypes that would revolutionize the field. It hadn't taken long for Koska to become caught up in the parapsychologist's enthusiasm. By the time they'd parted ways, Koska was willing to take a closer look at Mason's proposal. A demonstration of an early prototype of the Necro Helmet had led to him quickly signing a generous check. Koska wasn't looking to make a return on his investment. He didn't foresee a future where Mason's technological breakthroughs would turn a profit. This was purely about expanding humanity's understanding of the existential mysteries that had baffled philosophers and mystics since the dawn of time. Koska hoped Mason's work might provide an answer to the oldest question of them all. Did human consciousness survive death? It was a question that had kept Koska up many a night as he contemplated his sister's murder. Over the years, he'd hired the best psychics money could buy to inspect the library where the cult leader had driven his blade into her heart, desperate to know if maybe some part of her remained in our world. No one had ever picked up any psychic residue, and he hoped it meant his sister was at peace, wherever she was. After hearing Talon's report on what had transpired at the Regional National Mall, it seemed like his investment into the Nexus Foundation had been the right move. As soon as he got off the phone, he'd had his driver take him to the airport where his private Learjet was fueled and ready for takeoff. An hour later, he was in the air on his way to Ohio, fielding a series of calls with Dr. Mason. The Nexus Foundation and their Spirit Breaker program were about to get a chance to prove themselves in the field. Koska was planning on joining him in person, a development that caught Talon off guard. As a special operator, he was used to a lot of autonomy and didn't like the idea of the billionaire looking over his shoulder during a mission. Talon had no problem operating within a team, but Koska was a civilian ill-prepared for what he might encounter on the front of his occult war. He was still pondering Koska's impending arrival when sleep overtook him. The next morning, his chirping cell phone awoke him. Koska was already outside in a car. A quick shower later, Talon slipped into the back of the billionaire's limo and they merged into morning traffic. He could feel Koska's eyes on him and he shot his benefactor a dark grin.
I know. I look like shit. Seeing dead people doesn't agree with me.
He took a deep sip of the coffee he'd grabbed on the way out of the hotel and wished he'd spiked it with something stronger. He pointed to the two small white streaks on his sideburns that hadn't been there the day before.
A souvenir from last night.
The shock of the spectral entity passing through you can disrupt melanin levels, Koska said.
Talon shook his head with disbelief.
How would you know something like that?
Wait, don't tell me.
Rain pelted the windshield, but the gray weather wasn't impacting the billionaire's buoyant mood. It was impossible not to pick up on the man's excited energy. Koska reminded him of a gung-ho new recruit eager to take on the enemy. Once the bullets started flying and blood began to flow, he might change his tune. "So what's the plan?" Talon asked. "Are you familiar with the Nexus Foundation?"
"Should I be?"
"They're the world's leading experts on anomalous phenomena, a fancy term to describe ghosts."
"You live for this shit, don't you?"
Koska shrugged sheepishly.
"We all have our interests."
More like an obsession, Talon thought. An obsession he was beginning to share. He pondered the billionaire's words. They'd often discussed the two universal forces coursing the universe, the light and the darkness. Both of these power sources could be accessed through occult ritual, and he'd both confronted the darkness and tapped into the light. Despite numerous conversations, ghosts and spirits were a subject they'd barely touched upon. He remembered the apparition of Michelle he thought he'd seen during his life-and-death battle with Zagan. At the time, he'd been convinced she'd returned to give him strength. Later on, he wasn't so sure and seriously wondered if he might have imagined the whole thing. As a professional soldier, death cast a large shadow over him, now more so than ever. Nevertheless, he never had dwelled too much on the possibility of life after death. Figuring out life was hard enough. Part of his pragmatic character was to avoid wasting time on questions for which there were no definitive answers. "Where are we going, by the way?"
"The Nexus Foundation is sending out some of their people to help us with our current problem. Dr. Adira Austin is their top parapsychologist, and I have a feeling she'll have some helpful advice as we prepare to face the Reaper."
Talon nodded, but the idea of setting foot in the abandoned mall again filled him with dread. "You know this stuff is insane."
"It's a hell of a thing to wrap your mind around, but it also illustrates how little we know about the world beyond. The Foundation's philosophy is to use the scientific approach when it comes to the supernatural."
Koska's face lit up with passion as he continued.
"Nexus holds some of the best-equipped parapsychological labs in the country. Their scientists are investigating what mystics have been talking about for centuries. Quantum physics, string theory, dark matter, new models of the nature of reality. Cutting-edge, groundbreaking stuff."
"How much do they know about us, about what we do in the front lines of this battle?"
"They know you work for me, and that I have an interest in stopping occult threats, the Reaper being one of them. Beyond that, Dr. Mason and his team know not to ask too many questions."
"I see." Talon still felt uncomfortable about turning this mission into a group effort. The Foundation and Koska were unknown variables that made the ultimate outcome of the mission harder to predict. But he could use some help. The Reaper and his followers weren't like any enemy he'd ever faced before. The limo pulled up to an office building and drove into its underground parking structure. It was time to learn about ghosts.
Chapter 12.
Adira was surprised to discover that Koska had rented the entire top floor of a downtown Ampton office building for the upcoming meeting. How much money did the man have to throw around? Her surprise deepened when she met the handsome, boyishly good-looking man. She had expected someone older, more serious-looking. Koska clearly was a jet-setter, but there was an intensity and sense of focus to his demeanor that caught her off guard. She was even more taken aback by the intense man that accompanied him. Apparently, he'd survived an encounter with a malicious entity. Koska had jokingly introduced him as
Talon, the most dangerous man alive.
But something about the man's bearing convinced her that it wasn't an empty jest. The man radiated danger, projecting a palpable edge. Something in his gaze felt familiar, too. She'd spotted the same haunted expression on her own face in the wake of the traumatic events that had set her on her current quest to investigate the mysteries of the paranormal. Adira asked to take a quick look at the wounds from the ghostly attack. Laying eyes on Talon's scarred torso confirmed her first impression of the man. This wasn't one of Koska's golfing buddies who'd tagged along for the ride. Besides the numerous scars, which suggested a long, dangerous career that involved getting stabbed and shot, the man also boasted a fresh knife wound. Most disturbing of all was the inverted pentagram that someone had carved into his chest. Who was this man, and how did he know Koska? She suppressed the questions and focused on the task at hand.
"The burn marks are the result of a spirit's electrical field reacting to organic tissue," she explained as Chan snapped a series of photographs of the burn marks. It should heal up pretty quickly with proper treatment.
Sounds like I'm ready for round two. The comment made her smile, and Talon joined in, suddenly not looking quite so intimidating. Afterwards, they headed for the conference room where Casca quickly brought her up to speed on the Reaper case. The story felt fantastical, but the man's scars were real. She wondered what Talon had been doing at the Regional National Mall in the first place. Dr. Mason hoped to use the Spirit Breaker program to hunt and help ghosts, but what was Talon hunting? Whatever the explanation might be, both Casca and Talon were deadly serious about this business, and it immediately set the tone of their meeting. After Talon finished his story, there was a sense of expectation in the air. The two men were waiting for answers, and the ball was now in her court. It was time for her to show them what the Nexus Foundation had to offer, and that Casca's trust and confidence in them was warranted. "Most spectral entities pose no threat to the living," she explained. "Even if ghosts wanted to attack a person, they're unable to generate enough energy to affect human tissue. That's why the majority of people never actually see ghosts, but only report hearing strange noises or experiencing moving objects. Spectral apparitions have a tough time manipulating material reality. It's far more common for them to possess a human host and use them to harm others." There was a steely conviction in her voice. She was talking from personal experience.
"I guess the one I ran into is the exception to the rule. Lucky me."
Casca cocked an eyebrow and asked,
"Is there anything that could boost the power level of a spirit?"
Adira considered the question for a beat before she spoke.
"Ghosts give off electromagnetic energy, which is pretty much why any ghost hunter on reality TV worth his money has an EMF reader. Dr. Mason has speculated that entities may not merely emit EMFs, but also draw on them. In other words, an electromagnet could make a spirit more powerful."
Casca's face lit up with interest.
"What are you saying? There's an electromagnet inside the Regional National Mall?" "Possible, but we've also observed that specters have the ability to draw on certain humans in a similar fashion. Psychics, in particular."
"The Lightwalker," Talon said.
"He sounds like he may have the gift and is acting as the Reaper's psychic battery."
"So if we take out the Lightwalker, we won't have to worry about the Reaper," Talon said. Adira regarded Talon for a moment. The way he said, "take out," sounded suspiciously like he was talking about terminating the cult leader. Once again, she wondered who this man was and what his connection to Casca might be.
"In theory, it would weaken the entity. Reports of the hauntings at the National Regional Mall preceded the arrival of the Lightwalker, but his presence appears to have taken the entity's abilities to a whole other level."
Talon considered this and said, "How do I get past the Reaper? Casca said you guys could help." Adira took a deep breath and said,
"Let me show you."
Chapter 13. Adira started the next part of her presentation with a detailed rundown of the Necro Helmet. Talon was used to amazing military kit, from fusion, spiral-enhanced night vision goggles that allowed operators to pick up heat signatures, to the use of drones in combat. He'd handled some cutting-edge gear in his day. Despite these experiences, the tech that Dr. Adira was demonstrating seemed to have come straight out of a Marvel movie. If she was to be believed, the helmet would allow him to keep track of the Reaper at all times as if the ghost were a real person. Suddenly, Casca's investment in Nexus was beginning to make sense, and Talon wondered how much this had set back the billionaire. Some rich guys bought diamond rings for the Eastern European supermodels they were wooing. Casca clearly had other priorities. Talon donned the Necro helmet and activated the system. The conference room was bathed in a red tint. He tilted his head at Casca and said, "Should I take a selfie?"
"Cut it out," Casca said jokingly.
Talon turned toward Adira. "So what else have you got?" He wasn't quite sure what to make of the parapsychologist. Why would a young, attractive woman devote her life to the study of the supernatural? Had some past trauma pushed her toward this world? Was she, too, a victim of the occult? He promised himself to inquire further about the enigmatic doctor when he and Casca were alone again. His focus shifted back to Adira's presentation. She was pointing at a mannequin decked out in a futuristic bodysuit. It reminded him of a green wetsuit covered with a second layer of protection consisting of armor plates along the chest, calves, thighs, arms, and back.
Necro armor, all part of the Spirit Breaker system, Adira explained.
Spirit Breaker? Who came up with that one? Talon asked.
I believe that was the brainchild of the gentleman to your left.
Talon flashed the billionaire an appreciative look. Nice one, Casca.
The Spirit Breaker generates a magnetic field that wards off spectral energy sources, Adira said.
Talon remembered how the Reaper had reached into his chest. Such a suit would have come in handy during his last confrontation. Cool idea, but does it work?
We're about to find out, aren't we?
Adira said.
This will be the suit's first test run, but I assure you, the science behind it is quite sound.
I guess I'll have to take your word for it. Talon shot Casca a curious glance. So, how much did these toys set you back?
Casca pouted and said, You don't want to know.
Adira nodded at a pair of gloves that had been laid out on the conference table.
The gloves are made of the same material. If you make contact with a spectral energy field, an electromagnetic charge powers up the gloves, allows you to attack a ghost as if it were solid.
Adira turned toward a futuristic-looking rifle.
And finally, this is our Ectopulse rifle.
Personally, I was hoping we could just call it the ghost gun, but I was overruled, Casca commented.
Ignoring the comment, Adira continued.
The pulse rifle emits a concentrated magnetic distortion field.
It disrupts the coherence of ghosts.
What happens if I cross the streams?
The joke earned Talon a long look from everyone.
Whoa, tough crowd, he said.
The rifle won't destroy a ghost, but will slow it down, Adira said.
So how do I kill the Reaper?
You can't. At least, we don't have any technology that can permanently disintegrate a spectral presence.
Talon eyed Casca.
Do you have anything else useful in your magical arsenal? The Reaper sure didn't like your amulet.
Most entities aren't powered by the darkness directly, and the amulets and talismans tend to be useless against them. The Reaper's violent reaction to the pentacle suggests that his continued presence on this plane is the direct result of his black magic dealings.
Meaning what?
I studied some of the tattoos on his body. They are interesting.
Casca punched up a few photos on his smartphone and showed them to Talon and Adira. The image revealed a circle filled with triangles and exotic symbols that vaguely recalled the sigils the Apocalypse soldier had left behind in Father Cabrera's church in Arizona.
What am I looking at?
The symbol is used in forms of necromancy. You know what that is?
The magical ability to summon the dead, Talon said without hesitation. Casca paused, an eyebrow raised, and Talon grinned. I'm a fast learner. It was beginning to all make sense. The Reaper had used dark magic to remain in this world even after Detective Benson's bullets had struck him down. His powers remained weak, though, until the Lightwalker showed up and psychically weaponized the ghost. Talon turned to Adira.
So the Spirit Breaker will slow down the Reaper, but won't destroy him.
Hopefully it will buy you enough time to get to the Lightwalker. He is the psychic power source. Once he's dealt with, the Reaper will be less of a problem.
Is there a way to send this monster to hell for good? Talon asked.
There was a beat of hesitation before Adira spoke again.
If the Reaper's spirit took possession of a living person, and if that person were killed, both souls would phase over into the afterlife.
Good to know.
Talon paused for a beat before he said, There's something else. What do you think the Reaper's after? What's the end game here?
The dead don't have an end game, Adira explained. All that's left for them is to repeat the patterns that prevented them from moving on in the first place. They're trapped in an eternal loop. The Reaper's life was defined by murder and death, and this still holds true today.
Talon stepped up to the ecto-rifle and powered up the experimental ghost-hunting weapon. He regarded Casca with a deeper understanding.
You and Dr. Mason hope to turn the Spirit Breaker program into another unit of this war we're fighting, don't you?
That's the vision we share, Casca said. Some souls cannot accept their passing and become lost. They just need help, the kind of help Dr. Austin and her team can provide. Others are evil like the Reaper. Unwilling to face the afterlife, determined to remain on this world, their sole comfort, the misery and pain of the living.
You'll need soldiers to hunt those specters.
If we can find some recruits. Know anyone who might be crazy enough to sign up?
Only one person, and you're looking at him.
A red light ignited inside the ecto-rifle's main chamber, and his hands trembled with its surging power. Talon's lips stretched into a dark grin. The occult assassin was ready for his rematch.
Chapter 14. Casca had provided the Nexus team with a top-of-the-line mobile command center housed within a black bus. Adira, Chan, and the billionaire were hunched behind a series of monitors and computers in the main command area. The system would allow them to interface with the Necro Helmet and follow the action inside the haunted mall beat by beat in real time.
Talon emerged from the bus's restroom, now fully suited up in the necro armor. The material perfectly conformed to his body, almost as if it had been custom-made to his measurements. He'd initially worried the suit might be too bulky and constrain his mobility, but the opposite was true. The armor clung to him like a second skin, and he felt empowered and ready to go to war. Casca was the first to look up from one of the monitors.
How does it feel?
Where's the cape and cowl? There was a twinkle in Casca's eyes, but otherwise he maintained his poker face.
We should be reaching the mall in 15 minutes.
Talon nodded and turned toward the small arsenal mounted on the far wall of the comm center, not covered by terminals. He snatched his machine pistol and ran it through some quick checks, an old ritual that helped him calm his nerves and prepare for combat. Adira eyed him curiously.
You'll be taking conventional weapons along?
Your toys sound great, but they won't do much good against the Lightwalker and his killer cult. Adira didn't flinch. Talon wished he knew what was going through her mind. Judging from the expression on her face, she was beginning to realize that he didn't plan on taking any prisoners in this upcoming conflict. Could she be trusted once the bullets started flying and people were dying? Casca seemed to think so. Personally, he wasn't so sure. Not everyone out there approved of his brand of vigilante justice. He faced Adira and asked, "So how does one end up tracking spooks for a living?"
I'll tell you, if you tell me how you ended up with a pentagram carved on your chest.
Touché. Talon shrugged. I run into some freaky fellows in my line of work. Most times, they're just trying to kill me. Sometimes, they get creative. Adira was clearly still mulling this over when Casca interjected himself into the conversation.
What Talon is saying is that there are certain men out there intent on causing death and destruction, men who dabble in the occult and black magic.
And you hunt these men.
I stop them, Talon said.
I see. Sounds dangerous.
Talon shot a playful grin at his benefactor. The job comes with a pretty good medical plan. Isn't that right, Casca? The billionaire rolled his eyes. Okay, your turn. How did you get into all this? Adira's lip stretched into a thin line before she said,
You ever see the Carterville House Horror?
Talon searched his memory and shrugged. His day job nowadays was hunting nightmares, but ironically enough, he'd never been a big fan of thrillers. I'm more of a comedy guy.
That makes two of us.
She paused for a beat before she said,
The movie follows a pretty basic formula.
Family moves into haunted house, and weird stuff happens. Eventually, the evil spirit possesses the husband, and he murders the wife, two of the kids, and ultimately eats a bullet. That's probably why I skipped it. I like my movies to have a happy ending.
Then you'll be glad to hear that one person made it out alive. The teenage daughter survived the haunting.
Talon searched Adira's face, taken aback by the hollow tone in her voice.
The movie was based on a true story, Adira said, her voice drained of all emotion.
For a moment, Talon just stared at the parapsychologist, the enormity of what she was telling him sinking in.
I'm sorry. How? They said my dad lost it. His schizophrenia made him see visions, hear voices, but I was there. I saw the thing that took hold of him.
Adira turned back to the monitors, her hands trembling. The conversation was over. He eyed Casca, who confirmed the tale with a nod of his head. All three of them were victims of paranormal evil. Survivors. That was why Casca thought she could be trusted. In her own way, she was working toward protecting innocent lives from the supernatural. Adira's expression softened.
Sorry, I shouldn't have unloaded like that.
No worries, Talon said. I understand where you're coming from. To fight monsters, you have to know they're out there. Adira searched his face and nodded slowly, a newfound understanding between them. The mobile command center came to a halt. They'd arrived at their destination. He shouldered the machine pistol and wrapped a belt with ammo around his waist. Time to see how your toys hold up in the field.
I think I should go with you, Casca said.
I appreciate that, but trust me, it's a real bad idea. You're not trained to fight killers.
You could use some backup.
I know you practice martial arts and probably hit a shooting range once or twice a month, but this is the real deal. This is war. There was a beat between them, and Casca finally relented. Talon snatched the ectopulse rifle and slipped the necro helmet over his head. The scent of synthetic foam filled his nostrils. The weight and feel of the helmet added the surreal sensation that he was indeed entering a war zone. He headed for the exit of the black command bus. Outside, a heavy mantle of late afternoon mist enshrouded the regional National Mall. The monolithic structure extended like a malignant growth from the fog. Facing the haunted mall vividly brought back the horror of the other night.
You're crazy to do this all over again.
He suppressed his natural flight response. Doubt and fear were part of being human. Every time he'd parachuted into a war zone or closed in on a heavily fortified enemy position, nagging doubts had manifested themselves. The trick was to train your mind to not pay attention to them.
I must be a sucker for punishment,
he thought, as he sprinted toward the mall, mist weaving around him. The helmet amplified his breathing. Decked out in the imposing necro-armor, he looked like a futuristic soldier heading into battle on an alien world. One way he overcame combat anxiety was to focus on the mission and not the danger. He risked his life for a reason. He was making a difference. Each time he faced a new cult, he was, on some level, avenging Michelle all over again. But even more importantly, he wanted to prevent other victims from meeting a similar fate. He'd joined the military because he knew this was a big, bad world that needed people willing to put themselves in harm's way to make it a better place. The massive department store jumped into view. Ready for the next step, he removed a grappling gun from his belt, targeted the roof, and pulled the trigger. There was an explosive hiss from the CO2 cartridge, and the anchor shot toward the roof's ledge. The rope paid out, and the steel claw latched around a cooling pipe with an audible clang. He tested the rope, making sure it was securely anchored, and proceeded to scale the wall with quick, powerful strides. The suit slowed him down a bit, but he was used to carrying armor. A minute later, he stood atop the roof and shifted his focus to the large skylight before him. Jagged holes perforated the glass and offered a shadowy view of the mall's main plaza. He peered through the cracked wounds in the skylight and scanned the ground below. There were no signs of the cultists, and the helmet wasn't detecting any spectral activity.
Let's just hope this thing works, he thought.
He secured the rope and activated the ectopulse weapon. The hum of energy bashed the night. Gloved hands closed around the rope, and he carefully lowered himself through the maw of broken glass that jutted out like the teeth of some beast, his armor protecting him from the sharp edges. Repelling to the main plaza, a crimson darkness enveloped him. The helmet's ecto-spectral viewing system amplified the post-apocalyptic feel of his surroundings, and he struggled to shake the feeling that he was descending into the depths of Hades itself. Within seconds, his combat boots touched down on the ground. Machine pistol out and ecto-rifle powered up, he was prepared to rapidly switch between the two weapons if the situation called for it. The red darkness waited. All clear. Not picking up any signs of the... He broke off, having noticed something strange. The floor was covered with lumpy shapes, almost as if someone had dumped military sandbags across the mall's main plaza.
What is it?
Casca's voice crackled over the comm in his helmet. Talon approached the first shape and went stock still. He suddenly knew what he was looking at, and his stomach lurched. What he'd initially mistaken for sandbags were the bodies of the cult members, features obscured by their hoodies even in death. A feeling of dread slashed through him. He was standing at the center of a mass graveyard. He kneeled before the first dead cultist. A wide-eyed stare greeted him from beneath the hood as Talon turned him over, the dead man's neck coated red. He had opened his own throat with the crimson-caked sickle that lay on the floor next to his body. Looking more carefully at the corpse's arms, he noticed familiar tattoos. The same strange circle with triangles Casca had shown him earlier. The mark of the necromancer. The broken forms of the Lightwalker's followers lined the plaza as far as he could see. The colossal loss of life, the inherent madness in the act, it all revolted him. But San Francisco had taught him that mass suicide could power a cult ritual, so what purpose could this terrible sacrifice serve? A shrill beeping broke him out of his thoughts, and he realized the EMF reader in his right glove was picking up some crazy readings.
Talon, what the hell is going on?
Casca's words were drowned out by sharp bursts of static that quickly built into a bone-chilling, keening shriek. Something was out there in the dark. Something that regarded him as an intruder.
Talon!
He didn't respond. Every fiber of his being focused on the shifting mass of shadows before him. His breath clouded before him as blurry shapes separated from the encroaching darkness and appeared in the visualization system of the helmet. There was a swirl of rapid, staticky motion as, one after another, spectral silhouettes grew visible. They vibrated toward him, closing in from every direction, too many to count or keep track of. He performed a 360-degree scan of the plaza, ghosts everywhere he looked. Pallid monsters, eyes like pits, now pouncing toward him at predatory speed, moving in staccato bursts. The incoming specters phased in and out, a rapidly approaching swarm. The air charged, crackling with spectral static. The Reaper wasn't their only problem any longer. The bastard now commanded an army of the dead. Chapter 15. The screens inside the comm center exploded with spectral activity. Ghosts were homing in on Talon's position from every direction. "If you guys have any helpful advice, now would be the time to share it." Talon's voice filled the mobile command center, a trace of fear in his tone. The Delta operator had stared death in the face on more than one occasion, but engaging a swarm of spirits clearly wasn't something they'd covered at Fort Bragg. Adira clutched the edge of the console. She'd never experienced anything like this before. Back at the Santa Ana crash site, one apparition had been enough to send shivers of terror up her spine. Talon now faced about 20 of them, all weaponized by the Lightwalker's psychic power. The necro-armor and weaponry were designed to give Talon a fighting chance against the Reaper. With the help of Dr. Mason's spirit-breaker technology, he might be able to hold his own against one entity. No way in hell would he stand a chance against this army of wraiths. The entities were just too fast, too powerful for one man to successfully ward them off and not succumb to their overwhelming numbers.
"He needs our help," Casca said. He turned toward her. "Tell your driver to bring us closer to the mall. I'm going in." "You'll get yourself killed. What about Talon? If we don't help him, he's done for."
Adira nodded and palmed her mic.
"Steve, pull up to the main entrance of that JCPenney."
The next words were out of her mouth before she could stop herself.
"I'm coming with you."
Casca eyed her with surprise as the mobile command center burst into motion and shot toward the shopping center. Adira knew it was suicide, but if the billionaire was willing to risk his life, she couldn't stay behind. There were no spare suits, though fortunately they had a few extra rifles and helmets. "We'll see them coming, and might be able to hit a few, but we're going to be completely exposed," she thought, her heart pounding. The spirits they failed to stop would just pass through them and kill them instantly upon contact. What they were about to do was completely insane. Was this billionaire just an egomaniac with a death wish, and why was she following along with his madness? Chan jumped up from the comm center's flashing screen, a disturbed expression etched into his face. What was it now?
"We have another problem. The Ampton police scanners are going nuts. Sounds like the whole precinct is about to descend on this mall. All units are being rerouted."
Almost as if to lend weight to Chan's words, sirens filled the night. The first cops were closing in.
"What's going on?"
Casca's eyes glittered with dark realization.
"This is what it's all been about," he said. "The copycat murders, going after Benson, gathering a new following. The Reaper is repeating the past."
Casca was echoing her earlier words. The Reaper was about to relive the confrontation that had cost him his life, but this time around he'd have a horde of spooks at his disposal, and the outcome of the battle would be quite different. Chapter 16. The ectopulse rifle hummed with power as Talon lined up one of the ghosts in its crosshairs and squeezed the trigger.
"Here we go."
No laser beam or projectile shot out of the weapon's muzzle. Instead, an invisible magnetic wave warped and distorted the spirit's shape before obliterating it into whirling tendrils of energy. There was no time to marvel at the rifle's power. More specters were zeroing in on his position, and Talon unleashed a firestorm of ectosonic destruction. He kept moving as he fired, desperate to break out of the tightening band of ghosts. For each spirit he destroyed, two new ones took its place. How to escape an enemy that wasn't bound by space, an enemy that couldn't be killed because it was dead already. Even though the magnetic waves tore the spirits apart, they'd be able to reconstitute themselves seconds later. Talon was no stranger to overwhelming odds. There had been many a close call back in Afghanistan when it appeared the Taliban would overrun his team. Superior firepower and training counted for a lot, but
Being outnumbered by an endless stream of enemies would break the strongest fighting force in time. But at least the terrorists had been flesh and blood. Facing the dead was fraught with existential terror that easily invited despair. The air rippled and a phantom materialized to his right. The entity tore into Talon, but unlike the attack by the Reaper the other night, it wasn't able to pass through his body. His necro-armor lit up with sizzling energy as the apparition made contact. The ghost reared back, its howl reverberating over the helmet's speakers. The shrieking voices of the dead cultists cried out in unison, a dirge of the damned. Talon wished he could just kill the audio and shut out the unnerving sounds. Seeing these lost souls was bad enough. Having to listen to their unearthly cries was unbearable. He retreated, blasting away, more machine than man as he carved a path through the ghostly horde. Two spirits burst from the floor and attacked. The armor repelled them, but the impact sent him flying. He banged into the ground, his helmet cracking against the stone surface. Reality frizzed out for a second as the paraspectral visualization system went offline. For one blissful moment, his view screen turned dark, the ghosts vanishing from view, the keening cries dying down. The spirits were still present, but invisible to his senses, a welcome illusion of being alone in the now eerily quiet plaza. The respite from the ghostly onslaught didn't last as the system came back online and a phalanx of fast-approaching specters invaded his reality. They may have succeeded in hurtling him to the ground, but the necro-armor was holding its own. He remembered all too well how the Reaper had dragged Benson's frame across the ceiling. These ghosts could pass through matter, enter his body, stop his heart, or toss him around like a rag doll. This suit was saving his ass. Imagine an entire strike force outfitted in Spiritbreaker technology. A group like that would demolish any supernatural threat they encountered. Then again, maybe that was Casca's plan all along when he'd invested in the Spiritbreaker technology. As much as he marveled at the new battletech, Talon was an old-fashioned soldier at heart. He went to check his trusty machine pistol and realized that it must have been lost in the fray. No time to dwell on it as another specter surged into his body armor and violently reared back in a flash of sizzling energy. Talon cut a hasty retreat into the food court's maze of bolted-down tables and chairs. The spirit shimmered after him, passing through solid objects as if they weren't there, unaffected by the material world. Within seconds, the entity was upon him, bony hands reaching. Talon's gloved fist snapped out in a punch. Instead of slipping through the immaterial assailant, it made contact with the ghost. A shockwave of white-hot energy erupted on impact. Talon stumbled backward, sensed movement above him. He looked up and saw a specter suspended in midair. A pallid, cadaverous monster with a vague impression of features. A mouth like a raw wound, eyes like black marbles. He brought up the ecto-rifle, fired. A burst from the weapon seemed to decapitate the entity in mid-descent, the ghostly body crumpling. One thing was for certain, the specters were noticeably slower than the Reaper. If the ghosts drew power from the Lightwalker, perhaps powering so many of these entities was taking its toll on him. If the psychic's energy was now dispersed among too many ghosts, it offered a glimmer of hope. Maybe, if he could hold them back long enough, this army of the dead might exhaust the cult leader. Of course, that gave rise to another important question. Where the hell was the psychic? The sound of creaking metal suddenly cut through the food court, and a series of violent tremors rattled the bolted-down furniture. Steel screamed, and an invisible force ripped a table from its anchoring, the spirits combining their energy to manipulate physical reality. With an ear-splitting screech, the table shot toward Talon. His necro-armor could deflect spirits, but was useless against material objects. The bastards had already adjusted their tactics. The table rammed into Talon and sent him flying. A nearby gated-up storefront filled his field of vision, followed by the inevitable teeth-chattering impact. Metal creaked as he crumpled to the ground, and he exhaled sharply. The armor had cushioned the fall somewhat, but he sensed this was merely the beginning of his opponent's new strategy. Who knows what else these ghosts might throw at him? Firing non-stop, he scrambled back to his feet. As he looked up, Talon saw the Reaper looming right in front of him. The unholy master of the spectral horde had arrived. Chapter 17. Casca shoved the door open and burst into the foggy night. The driver had, as instructed, pulled the mobile command center right up to the JCPenney's main entrance. The billionaire had activated both his necro helmet and ecto rifle, and his body was burning up with adrenaline. Strange to feel so alive when he was about to face the dead. Adira appeared on his side, the vibration of her own weapon cutting the silence of the night. He'd read up on the parapsychologist soon after his meeting with Dr. Mason, and had found her backstory fascinating. Here was a woman who had survived a haunting that destroyed her entire family. But instead of letting her experiences crush her spirit, she'd risen above past trauma and remade herself. From the easy way she handled the rifle, Casca guessed she hadn't spent the last few years exclusively with her head buried in books. He barreled toward the entrance, Adira trailing him. Rifles leading the way, they barged into the mall and navigated the deserted department store. They made sure to stay close to each other and cover each other's backs. Every successive step brought them closer to the moment when they'd confront the Lightwalker's army of spirits. As they advanced, Casca's mind kept turning to that day in the library when the cult leader took his sister's life. He'd caught a glimpse of a dark shape among the aisles of books, a shifting silhouette of pure blackness, almost as if someone had carved a hole into the very fabric of reality. That defining incident had been his first and only tangible experience of the supernatural. He was about to receive a refresher course. His courage surprised him, but Talon needed help. The Delta operator was formidable, but this was a fight he could not win alone. 3 minutes later, the main plaza jumped into view, and Casca spotted the first entity. His heart raced, and his whole reality narrowed to that one detail, the shrieking spirit whirling toward them at breakneck speed. Rifle leveled, he pulled the trigger, and the magnetic wave obliterated the inhuman attacker. The thrill of his first spectral kill gave way to fear as more airborne entities zeroed in on him. He kept firing away at the incoming enemy while he combed the plaza for Talon. Where was the operator? Watch out! Adira's voice boomed over his helmet speakers. Casca spun around and saw one of the ghosts coming right at him. Fortunately, Adira vaporized the entity before it could embed itself into his flesh. He let out a sigh of relief and continued to blast the ghosts. Two dispersed, providing a clear view of Talon up ahead. He was pressed against a gated storefront, a dark silhouette closing in on him. Was it the Reaper? Casca pointed at Talon, and Adira's voice crackled again over his mic. I see him too. They both rushed toward Talon, blasting away. The semi-translucent figure descending on the man shattered under their sustained efforts. Casca knew it was merely a brief victory. Within seconds, the mass murderer's ghost would begin the process of regenerating itself. They'd been lucky thus far, but it was impossible to sustain this effort. The three of them started to draw closer, ecto-rifles firing non-stop. They faced an enemy that would never grow tired, never grow weaker in numbers, never would give up. We will not make it out of here, Casca realized. Unless... His eyes combed the food court and landed on a can of spray paint that one of the cultists must have dropped right next to where his body had fallen. It gave him an idea. He yelled into his mic, I have a plan. Let's form a circle. Keep your backs to each other. He sensed the Delta operator's hesitation, but the soldier knew from experience that even a bad plan was far better than no plan at all. Talon, I need your pendant. The operator quickly tossed him the amulet, but never stopped blasting away at the enemy. The billionaire draped it over his neck and said, Cover me, and stay close. He jumped forward, scooped up the can of spray paint, and drew a red circle around them. What are you doing, Casca? This is a hell of a time for a goddamned art project. Glad to hear your sense of humor is still intact. You guys have to trust me on this. Make sure to stay within the circle. Casca had studied the occult for more than a decade. He had internalized its mysteries, but only personally dabbled with ritualistic magic on a handful of occasions. Praying that he wasn't signing their death sentences, he whispered the words required to activate the protective circle's power. The incantation flew from his lips as he quickly drew four ancient Sumerian symbols inside the circle. Once done, the next step was to etch out a pentagram, a perfect replica of the pendant he now wore. Pentagrams had been a symbol of good until Satanists had perverted the symbol by inverting it in the name of the darkness. One of the first things Casca had learned was that not all magic was evil. There were rituals that tapped into the darkness, but others channeled the light.
Up until right now, most of his occult knowledge had been of an intellectual nature. It was time to test his expertise in the field. How he wished he could have done so without a lethal swarm of phantoms swirling around him. But sometimes necessity was the kick needed to turn theory into practice. He'd almost finished reciting the spell when one of the ghosts circumvented the magnetic blasts from Talon and Adira's ecto-rifles and surged right at him. Did the specter sense what he was up to? Adira stepped in front of the ghost, buying him precious seconds. As the spirit flung her out of the circle, he mouthed the last words of the incantation. The protective circle lit up. Three more ghosts charged, but they violently recoiled upon hitting the circle's perimeter. It was almost as if an invisible force field was warding them off, the magical power of the circle activated. Even though he couldn't make out Talon's features, he knew the man was staring at him from behind the helmet. How would he adapt to the idea that his general was dabbling with the very forces they'd sworn to battle? Their momentary victory was bittersweet. He couldn't pull his gaze from Adira's motionless form, sprawled next to the dead cultists on the ground. There was no time for grief, as more specters made a go at them. The ghosts repeatedly dashed against the magical ring, and each time the power of the circle repelled them. They were unable to penetrate the barrier, at least for now. Casca wasn't sure for how long the circle would maintain its magic under such a sustained pounding. His gut told him it wouldn't be for much longer.
"There are too many," he said to Talon. "They're going to break through any..."
The barrage suddenly stopped. The specters froze. For a moment, Casca wondered what was going on. The keening shrieks on his necro-helmet were now replaced with another sound, the deafening pop-wash of an incoming helicopter and the wail of sirens. The police had arrived, and the officers were about to walk into a supernatural ambush. They weren't prepared for what they'd find in the mall. How many cops were about to lose their lives? The ghosts were pulling away from the circle, gearing up for their next assault. Their terrible mass suicide had turned the cult into an unbeatable weapon, a weapon about to be targeted against the hapless officers entering the mall. Footsteps echoed in the dark. The lightwalker approached the circle. He was wise enough to keep his distance, just beyond the reach of Talon's grasp. The bastard knew exactly how close he could get to them. Ghosts swirled around his form, the air shimmering with inhuman energy. The lightwalker turned toward him, their eyes meeting. Casca immediately realized that powering this many spirits was taking a heavy toll on the psychic. Cataracts had formed around bloodshot eyes, and his skin was wrinkled and loose, aged beyond his years.
"The Reaper is consuming his life force," Casca thought. Draining him like a battery.
How much longer before he'd burn out for good? His heart sank when he realized the Lightwalker's weakened state wouldn't prevent what was about to happen next. The psychic had found Talon's machine pistol and was now pointing the weapon right at them.
"Maybe your little circle can keep ghosts out," he said. "But I wonder how it will fare against bullets."
Chapter 18. Adira's eyes snapped open. Reddish darkness enveloped her. After a panicked moment, she remembered that the visualization system of her helmet was active, and she was staring up at the mall's skylight, occasional entities zipping through her field of vision. They'd lost interest in her now that their master had arrived. Adira should have been dead. A normal person would have succumbed to the spectral invasion of her body. But she'd never been quite normal. According to the Nexus Foundation's battery of psi tests, she qualified as a level 2 psychic. In comparison, someone like the Lightwalker had to score over 10 on the tests. But her abilities, slight as they might be, had probably saved her life as a teenager. Even though her psychic perception was weak, and she still required the necro helmet to see the dead, she'd been able to catch brief glimpses of the entity that had taken hold of her father. She'd seen enough to know that her father hadn't been the one to pull the trigger that day, that ghosts were real. Later, once she'd learned more about anomalous phenomenon, she wondered whether she'd been indirectly responsible for the haunting. Had her psychic energy activated the spirit the same way the Lightwalker now powered the Reaper? The discovery had been accompanied by a crushing sense of guilt. It had sent her on a psychological tailspin that would include a vicious cycle of alcohol and drugs.
but she'd overcome the past and sworn to find redemption at the Nexus Foundation. She shook off the memories and instructed her brain to focus on the problem at hand. Her peripheral vision revealed a figure striding past her, dressed in brilliant white, but clearly just a man, the Lightwalker. He was inexorably closing in on Talon and Casca, who were huddled close to each other in the protective circle, rifles ready. Ghosts were rippling toward them, but an invisible wall of some kind was deflecting their attacks. Adira was still trying to make sense of it all when the Lightwalker bent down and scooped up the machine pistol Talon had dropped earlier. It all came together in her mind. The entities were unable to reach the men, but bullets would. She had to stop the Lightwalker, and that meant she needed a weapon. As soon as the thought slashed through her mind, her eyes fell on the knife of one of the dead cultists. Tapping into her last reserve of strength, she crawled toward the downed hoodie. The Lightwalker was talking, but she mentally blocked out his words. Fueled by sheer willpower, she reached the corpse and her fingers tightened around the sickle. "I can do this. I have to do this." She gritted her teeth and willed herself to her feet, muscles screaming in protest in an excruciating effort. One weak step at a time, she closed in on the psychic whose back remained turned toward her. He must have sensed her approach at the last moment. He turned, but by then it was too late. Before he could shoot Talon and Casca, before he could even cry out, Adira brought the sickle down on the Lightwalker. The white fabric of his hoodie turned crimson. A beat later, the cold metal of the machine pistol dug into her face. Chapter 19. A shocked Talon stared at Casca through the viewscreen of his necro-helmet. The system's red tint gave the billionaire a demonic quality, an impression further enhanced by the guttural words of the incantation. Talon couldn't believe it. The man he'd come to trust was using the same occult forces they were supposed to protect the world from. The insight made him lose his focus for a second, and one of the ghosts broke through their defense. The entity went straight for Adira. The wail of the damned drowned out her screams as the corpse-like spirit hurled her out of the protective circle. Talon's gut clenched, and his lips tightened into a hard line as the ghost buried itself inside Adira's body. He blasted the entity, knowing full well it was a futile effort. The darkness had found another victim. There'd been so many, but he couldn't allow himself to dwell on it. Not now. Not here. The other spirits hovered above them, ever shifting, endlessly breaking down and reforming as they slithered through the air. More specters attacked, but bounced back before they could make contact. The ring Casca had drawn on the ground had conjured some invisible force that was stopping their advance. What sort of magic was the billionaire tapping into? The answer would have to wait. The Lightwalker was approaching the circle, sporting the machine pistol Talon had dropped earlier. His eyes glittered with deadly intent as he spoke. He was about to squeeze the trigger when Adira came into view behind him, sickle in hand. A feeling of relief washed over Talon. She's alive. The curved knife in her hand slashed out at the psychic. Talon saw his opportunity to make a move. Ecto-rifle blazing, he stepped out of the circle and surged for the Lightwalker. The psychic was about a second away from pumping around into Adira when Talon attacked. His first punch aimed for the psychic's wound. The Lightwalker let out a piercing wail as Talon's fist found the bleeding knife wound. The psychic stumbled backward while he stitched his surroundings with lead. Bullets chopped mortar and punched through the dead cultists. Both Talon and Adira hit the ground, bullets sizzling overhead. As soon as the barrage ceased, Talon followed Adira's earlier example and snatched a sickle from one of the dead cultists. Armed, he launched back to his feet and faced the Lightwalker. The psychic tossed away the empty machine pistol, lips twisting into a snarl as his sickle shot out at Talon, cutting the air inches away from his face. The next blow Talon parried with his own sickle, steel kissing steel. He lunged forward, knife out, pushing the psychic back. Suddenly a dark silhouette shot out of the cement floor, blocking the psychic from harm. The Reaper had joined the fight. The thrust meant for the Lightwalker cut through the entity's translucent, unstoppable form. The Reaper lunged at him, and the resulting electrical discharge between ghost and necro-armor catapulted Talon a few feet back. Shaken, he barely maintained his balance and went into a combat stance. He tried to sight down the Reaper with his ecto-rifle, but the Lightwalker's sickle whistled toward him from another angle. Servant and master, the living and the dead, attacking at the same time from separate directions, both joining forces in a combined effort to destroy their new enemy. The knife in Talon's right hand blocked the Lightwalker's sickle, while his other hand blasted the Reaper backward with repeated shots from his ecto-rifle. Howls of agony filled his helmet as the magnetic waves drove the Reaper back and vaporized the living shadow. No time to celebrate as the Lightwalker lashed out at him once again. Already, dark contours grew visible nearby as the Reaper reconstituted itself. This entity was unstoppable. Tendrils of energy engulfed his armor, but this time the suit failed to protect Talon. The Reaper held on with all its might, the ever-shifting form refusing to let go. The dead mass murderer's horrific visage loomed mere inches before Talon, a withered, flayed bone mask that recalled the skeletal visions he'd had back in Mexico City. Talon felt the suit succumbing to the entity's sustained efforts. Cracks appeared, and then pieces of armor began breaking off. A keening shriek filled his helmet, the rage of the Reaper given full expression. Talon's armor ripped, and the chest plate hit the ground in an explosive spray of metal and circuitry. Other spirits, emboldened by the Reaper's success, pulled on Talon's arms and legs. They clung to the armor despite the waves of agony it must have triggered in their vibrating spectral forms. More armored plating snapped off and clattered to the ground, the skin-tight bodysuit shredding. Spent, Talon joined his shattered necrosuit on the stone floor, fully exposed now. Vulnerable. The remaining armor hung from his battered frame in tatters. The next attack would penetrate flesh. The band of spirits tightened around him. Talon braced himself for the inevitable. But then the specters froze. Almost as if some invisible force had snapped them back in mid-attack. The hands of the nearest ghost were still reaching for his exposed chest. The Reaper and his spectral forces hung in the air as if in suspended animation. There was only one possible explanation. Casca. Talon whirled toward the billionaire. His benefactor's left arm was drenched in blood, a red sickle in his other hand. His features remained invisible under the helmet, but Talon knew he still had to be mouthing the guttural words of some ancient incantation. The protective circle had only been the first step, an effort designed to buy Casca enough time to complete the real ritual, one that required an offering of blood. And it wasn't over yet. The specters began to rush toward the stunned Lightwalker. One by one, the entities slammed into him like sizzling bolts of lightning. A scream erupted from the psychic's mouth and echoed across the plaza. Talon fought back revulsion as he saw the stark outlines of the cultists' faces beneath the Lightwalker's flesh, struggling to break free of their new prison. Somehow, Casca had forced the spirits back on the psychic. Their efforts distended the blood-smeared white hoodie, their inhuman features stretching the Lightwalker's skin and distending bone. Dominating the screaming faces of the dead was the Reaper. His mouth scowled with unbridled fury. Talon recalled Adira's earlier words. If the Reaper's spirit took possession of a living person, and if that person were killed, both souls would phase over into the afterlife. He knew what had to be done, and strode up to the writhing psychic with quick steps. The Lightwalker's features looked wizened, his spent life force having aged him prematurely. Without hesitation, Talon grabbed the psychic's neck and wrenched it with all his strength. Bone cracked, and the Lightwalker's lifeless body slumped forward. The parade of ever-shifting faces stopped before he reached the ground. Talon breathed deeply. It was over. His eyes found Adira and Casca. Now the only signs of life in a place of death. In their futuristic necro-helmets, they looked like triumphant robotic warriors towering over some post-apocalyptic battlefield. Talon turned back to the broken psychic at his feet. Did the dead truly walk into the light? No one alive knew the answer. All he could hope was that the Reaper and his disciples dwelled in the darkness, wherever they might be. Chapter 20. Adira had made a promise, and she intended to keep it. She was back at the crash site in the Santa Ana Mountains. This time around, she wasn't afraid. The air stirred and rippled, and the apparition flitted across her helmet's visor.
I know you're scared, she said. Alone, confused, but I can help you.
The figure peeled from the shadows of the surrounding trees, a hint of alabaster features, haunted eyes. She had gone over the crashed plane's passenger list and looked at over 100 faces. The heart-wrenching experience had driven home the full extent of the tragedy. Based on the photographs, she'd quickly established the identity of the spirit in the clearing. Maybe her psychic abilities had grown since the spectral attack back at the mall, or maybe they'd always been there, laying dormant, merely waiting to be awoken. But when she stared at the photograph of Harry Wells, a 35-year-old investment banker, she'd felt a spark. This was the man she'd seen in the barren foothills. There was a seriousness of purpose to the face in the picture. He was the type of pragmatic man who believed only in that which he could see, hear, and touch. The type of man who might not accept survival after death. Even though the features of the apparition remained blurred, she recognized the man from the photograph. Harry, do you want to talk?
Where am I? Who are you?
My name is Adira. I'm hoping to help you. And to answer your question, you're in the Santa Ana Mountains. The words hung there.
I'm on my way to Las Vegas.
Not anymore. She extended a hand toward the entity. You never arrived at your destination. The entity closed in. Adira remained strong and held her ground. She was determined to see this through, to help Harry move on to the next world.
I was on a plane,
he said slowly.
I was looking at the mountains, and then I heard shrieks. Someone was yelling.
There was a sob, elongated and eerie, a pitiful sound not produced by human vocal cords.
The woman next to me. She held my hand.
They're waiting for you, Harry. Waiting for you to join them, Adira said kindly.
Are you sure? Death is only the beginning.
The Lightwalker's ominous message now held seeds of hope, a promise of a greater destiny that lay ahead beyond the boundaries of human existence. Detail and color returned to the ghost's features, and the figure straightened. For a second, he looked alive again, and then the presence was gone. Harry had finally joined the others. Tears streamed down Adira's face, but this time, they were tears of joy. 2 days had passed since the climactic battle with the Reaper. Talon had demanded a sit-down with Casca. They needed to talk. The billionaire's use of the occult ritual had been eating away at him, and he needed to air his feelings if this partnership was to have a future. Casca picked a seafood restaurant near his Silicon Valley corporate headquarters. To Talon's surprise, Casca was the one to cut right to the chase before they even ordered.
I know what's on your mind, Sergeant.
We fight the occult, Casca. How can I trust a man who's tapping into the very forces we're trying to defeat?
I understand how you feel, but please, hear me out. If we're to win this war, we'll need to both understand our enemy and adapt some of his tactics.
And what happens when the line begins to blur? When there's no difference between us and them?
The pentacle around your neck. The Demon Slayer blade. These are magical relics, Talon, that tap into the light. Magical weapons. The ritual I used was an extension of that.
Talon shook his head. I've studied enough of your books to know it was a blood sacrifice.
That's true, Casca conceded.
I'm worried. I've seen the books and occult items at your house. If you were to become corrupted by one of these rituals or the items in your possession...
I'm treading lightly, I promise, but if something were to happen, I know of one man out there who would be able to stop me.
Talon tightened his lips.
I hope it never comes to that.
Casca pulled out a small metal case and handed it to Talon. What's that?
Let's call it an early Christmas present.
Talon opened the case and immediately recognized the item inside. It was the Demon Slayer blade that he'd lost during the fight with Zagan at Omicron.
As promised, I made some calls. Detective Cerrone was nice enough to get this out of evidence for me, no questions asked.
How is she?
Moving on with her life, like we all should.
Talon mulled this over, but said nothing. After a moment, Casca held out his hand.
Peace, for now.
Talon looked deep into the billionaire's eyes and saw that the man's intentions were pure. He took the hand in his own and shook it. Peace. Even though their talk had reassured him somewhat of Casca's intentions, a famous quote from Nietzsche popped into his head. Beware that when fighting monsters, you yourself don't become a monster. It would serve them well not to forget the philosopher's insight into human nature. They were both at risk in their own way. War could erode one's humanity. Casca broke him out of his thoughts.
Have you ever been to Italy?
Why do I get the feeling I'm about to?
It would be that chance to trace the Talon family tree.
If you put it like that.
But first, let's eat. I hear both the lobster and Bradetto are amazing here.
Talon focused on the menu and pushed his concerns aside. As soon as the waiter took their order, he became thoughtful once more. His experiences in Ohio had taught him a vital life lesson. Death wasn't the end. Somewhere out there, a part of Michelle went on. She might be waiting for the day when they'd be reunited again. For now, he'd continue to battle the darkness. But when his time finally did come, he wouldn't be afraid of the light.
Coffin Collector. The story so far. After a decade spent fighting the enemy abroad and keeping his country safe, Delta Force operator Mark Talon is ready to settle down with the love of his life. But Talon's world crumbles when his fiancée becomes the victim of a murderous cult. In the wake of his terrible loss, Talon dedicates himself to a new mission, hunting down twisted occultists around the globe and stopping them before they can unleash the forces of darkness upon an unsuspecting world. In Coffin Collector, his quest for vengeance will take him to Florence, Italy. 1. Darkness greeted Travis Williard upon waking. Instead of looking up from a soft bed at the wood ceiling beams of his studio apartment, he found himself confined in a black and soundless space. He tried to move left and right, only to realize he was boxed in. Frantically, he tried to sit up, but banged his head against a wooden surface. His pulse quickened, and he fought back the first signs of claustrophobia.
Where am I?
He shifted about and explored his extremely tight quarters by touch. He was encased in something. He pressed against the rough wooden ceiling of his new prison, his labored breaths amplified in the tight space. Soon words tumbled from his lips, nearly unintelligible in his parched throat, building into terrified screams.
Hello? Let me out of here! Somebody help me!
There was no response.
Oh my God, what's happening? How did I get here?
Travis searched his memory. Through the haze of last night's binge drinking and the terrible hangover splitting his head, he vaguely remembered spending the evening at Rivolta, one of the poshest bars in town. He was 4 weeks into his summer semester at the Florence University of the Arts and was having the time of his life. As an art student, he cherished this beautiful European city and all its historical relics and artistic masterpieces. Engaging classes during the day gave way to a different kind of stimulation when the sun went down and the local beauties hit the discotheques and bars. Travis appreciated art in all its forms, particularly the female form, and he had been meeting his share of lovely and willing locals. He wanted this to be a summer to remember, a final hurrah before returning to New York, where graduation and the responsibilities of adulthood would be waiting for him. He was madly in love with the city, and the city had returned his passion in kind, until now. He dimly recalled two lovely girls chatting him up at the bar. He had bought them drinks, the place had started spinning, and that's when the memories stopped. He must have passed out, but why? He considered himself a seasoned drinker. A few Negronis wouldn't knock him off his feet. There was only one explanation. Someone must have spiked his drink. It was absurd. Why would anyone kidnap him? Granted, Americans weren't the most popular people around with many of the locals, but still, as some of the Italian girls had explained after a passionate night of lovemaking, people from the U.S. were spoiled, arrogant, and loud, but also a lot of fun and good in the sack. Young people might be drawn to them, but the older population considered them a cultural blight. Travis had received confirmation of this a few nights earlier, when he had stumbled drunkenly through the city's streets, one of his buddies singing at the top of his lungs. A window above them opened, and a disgruntled Florentian dumped a bucket of ice-cold water on top of them. They'd laughed their asses off at the time, but what if some local felt water wasn't enough to teach the foreigners a lesson? Clenching his teeth, he kicked and slammed the wooden ceiling of the box with all his might. This time, the lid popped open. Harsh light flooded in. Travis blinked, shielding his eyes, and recognized with horror that he'd been trapped in a coffin all this time. He scrambled out of the casket as fast as possible, shaking all over. What the fuck? Was this some sick joke? For a second, he expected his guffawing buddies to pop out from behind the coffin and provide him with a legitimate reason to punch their lights out.
but no human laughter joined in with his anxiety-ridden gasps. As his breathing normalized, he began to inspect his environment more carefully. He was inside an immense high-ceilinged warehouse. Murky light shafted into the cavernous space through a series of skylights, revealing a sight that made his blood run cold. Everywhere he turned, rows upon rows of coffins stretched out before him, an eerie maze of death. They came in all shapes, sizes, and materials, wood, metal, and even fiberglass. Some were elaborately adorned, while others appeared simple and basic. This place was a museum dedicated to the art of coffin making. Inhaling deeply to stave off his fear, Travis stumbled through the grotesque labyrinth, shaken by the morbid, surreal setting. He needed to find a way out. His searching gaze paused on an exotic glass sarcophagus. The outline of a man was barely discernible inside the coffin. Fighting back his terror, he approached the glass sarcophagus and caught a better look at the figure resting inside. Sunken, waxy figures indifferently regarded the world, the skin covered by a thin veneer of paint, which gave the body a doll-like quality. But this was no doll. This man had once been alive. Another horrible idea occurred to him. What if this corpse wasn't the only one? What if every one of these coffins contained a preserved body? A voice in his head told him to keep moving, but instead he closed in on the nearest casket, its faux gold handles gleaming in the milky light filtering into the warehouse. Giving himself an internal push, Travis opened the lid and froze. The mummified remains of a woman stared back at him. Her empty eye sockets bored into Travis as if she blamed him for her horrific state. That did it. He'd seen enough. Travis whirled and ran. There had to be an exit somewhere. Behind him, he heard a noise. He slowed, his panicked gaze combing the warehouse. Was that movement behind a row of caskets? More footsteps echoed in the warehouse. They seemed to come from different sides of the labyrinth. That meant more than one person was stalking him. What sick game were these freaks playing? No time to dwell on it. Travis kept moving, trying to be as noiseless as possible as he navigated the maze. His mind grew blank as he arrived at the center of the warehouse, where another surreal sight awaited. A rectangular stretch of soil dominated the space, the cement floor giving way to a large patch of earth about 20 feet long and 10 feet wide. An ancient-looking wooden casket rested in the middle of the plot, right next to an open grave. Something almost indefinable set this coffin apart from the others. A timeless, primal quality. Almost as if it originated from another world. Strange symbols and sigils lined the coffin's rough-hewn, organic-looking surface. The casket seemed imbued with unnatural life. Almost as if it had been constructed from flesh and bone instead of wood. Travis's skin grew clammy, and bile rose in his throat. The coffin's malevolent energy triggering a physical response. Acid churned in his gut. Another sound made Travis spin around. This time he caught a glimpse of one of his stalkers, a massive individual built like a professional wrestler. The man was bald, his square head the size of a bowling ball with rough-hewn, almost malformed features. He looked like he belonged to a different species of human, a missing step in the evolutionary ladder, perhaps. Travis's heart thrashed against his ribcage as he spotted the pistol in the man's grubby paw. More sounds rang out behind him, and two other figures peeled from the shadows of the coffins. One was tall and rail-thin, his hollow eyes regarding Travis with no emotion. The man next to him was normal-sized, but his pockmarked face held the same empty, soulless expression. The two men were dressed in expensive black suits, their polished exterior heightening instead of lessening their inherent savageness. Travis sensed these men hurt people for a living and weren't fazed by much in this world. They carried their brutality like a badge of honor. Another pair of footsteps cut through the warehouse. He turned and saw an old, wizened creature approaching, the ringleader behind the freak show. Immaculately dressed, projecting wealth and refinement, the man had to be at least in his 80s or 90s. Long silver strands of hair clung to his liver-spotted skull, and gnarled fingers clawed a cane. A blinding white suit, black loafers, and red shirt oozed Italian style and sophistication. The tanned, wrinkled skin clashed with the fabric's crisp sheen. Exotic rings adorned his bony fingers, and his gold watch glittered in the warehouse's pale light.
Who are you? What do you want from me?
Travis's voice sounded timid and terrified, and he wished he'd kept his mouth shut. Why provide these freaks with further satisfaction? Two of the men zeroed in on him. He flinched as they approached and backed away into the patch of soil. Powerful hands grabbed his arms and brusquely dragged him toward the waiting casket.
What the hell is this shit? Please, you can't do this. Help! Someone!
The words died on his lips as a fist snapped his head back. He spat blood. The third man removed the lid of the eerie coffin. Fear flickered over the goon's features. The kidnapper visibly shared Travis's atavistic revulsion for the coffin, and somehow that was the most terrifying thing yet. The lid landed in the dirt, the insides of the moldy coffin now revealed. Travis's heart skipped a beat. The wooden box waiting for him wasn't empty. Skeletal remains gleamed inside the casket, all flesh stripped clean from the yellowed bone. Travis couldn't fathom the dark motives driving these men, but their intent was clear. They planned to put him in the strange coffin with the skeleton and bury him inside this fucked-up warehouse of horrors. As soon as the horrible certainty sliced through his mind, one of the goons brought the handle of his pistol down on Travis's head. He slumped forward, hitting the ground face first, his blood mixing with the earth. The white pants and expensive loafers of the old man came into view. The figure paused at the edge of the soil bed, seemingly eager for a front row seat, but unwilling to get any dirt on those polished shoes.
"Bury him," the old man said in Italian.
From his peripheral vision, Travis saw one of the men snatch a shovel. The other two goons dragged Travis to his feet. He protested and pulled away, so they pistol-whipped him again for good measure. The world swam in and out of focus as it had the night before at the bar. That moment seemed so far away now, part of another reality. For a split second, he entertained the hope that it might all just be some nightmare. A warehouse full of coffins, the prospect of being buried alive, mummified corpses. This shit was textbook Freudian. But the sensation of his body being roughly lifted and dropped into the casket, the cracking of bones as his weight landed on the skeleton, the foul stench of the remains next to him, the tangible patina of reality felt too raw, too vivid to be a construct of his subconscious, even if helped along by some potent Italian liqueur the night before. Not even a full bottle of absinthe could conjure such a fucked-up mind trip. This shit was happening for real, and there was nothing he could do to stop it. He wanted to scream, but his lips didn't work. The casket's lid slammed shut, drenching him in renewed darkness. The next sensation was one of movement as the goons heaved the casket toward the waiting hole. Moments later, Travis's whole body shook as the coffin landed at the bottom of the freshly dug grave. The corpse's bones poked into him, and his head bounced against the sealed lid. He weakly pounded the walls of the coffin, blood bubbling down his lips. The oppressive darkness sapped his will to live, to fight. A slight vibration of something hitting the casket. Dirt, Travis realized. They were beginning to fill up the grave, bury him alive. A last vestige of survival instinct surged through his body. He pressed against the lid with all his strength, but it wouldn't budge despite his efforts. Tears stung his eyes. His pitiful sobs filled the yawning darkness. More dirt kept landing on the coffin, but the sounds quickly became muffled, distant. A strange feeling of peace and tranquility replaced his terror. Finally, the noise died down completely, the goons having completed their task. The stuffy air made him wonder how much oxygen was left in the casket. How long would he have? An hour? 30 minutes? He remembered stories of people being buried alive, horrific tales of bodies being exhumed, revealing broken, bloodied nails, even bitten off fingers or swallowed tongues. Travis didn't want to go that way. Would he just pass out, or would each breath begin to slowly strangle him as the precious oxygen turned into poisonous carbon dioxide? He thought of his mother back in Florida, of his younger sister about to start college in the fall at NYU. He thought of the last girl he'd slept with, the beautiful and spirited Maria. He'd hoped to run into her again at the bar where they first met. God damn it, he was leaving so much behind. No, this couldn't be happening. He wanted to live. Another sensation broke into his thoughts. Something stirred in the coffin.
His hair stood up as an icy hand closed around his throat. Maddened shrieks shattered the peaceful silence, and Travis realized he was hearing his own screams of terror. The hand tightened, crushing his throat, and his desperate cries abruptly silenced. 2. 91-year-old Marco Giallo observed in silence as his men dragged the American toward the waiting coffin. The art student was young and strong, a perfect specimen and well-suited for the ritual. For the coffin he would soon be buried in was no ordinary coffin. This was the casket of the famed German stage magician Bruno Zamora. Anticipation built inside of Giallo as the coffin descended into the grave. The boy would have at most an hour's worth of oxygen. They would dig him up long before he would run out of air, though. Unlike Giallo's previous victims, who now wild eternity away in his collection, the plan wasn't to kill the American. 10 minutes below ground should be enough to determine if all the stories about Zamora's legendary coffin held any truth. As far back as Marco Giallo could remember, coffins had been a part of his life. Giallo Cofani was one of the largest coffin manufacturers in Europe. His family had controlled the death industry for 4 generations and was still going strong. The colorful details of the business might change with time, but the grim bottom line remained the same. Bodies needed to be put into the ground. Generally, this required a coffin or casket. The company's motto was to produce beautiful coffins that you would love to die in. While the world succumbed to mediocrity, Giallo prized beauty. Unfortunately, the latest trend was to build less expensive models while expanding cremation offerings. Eco-friendly, biodegradable bamboo caskets were one of the newest fads that threatened the artistic integrity and craftsmanship that went into the creation of real coffins. Considering how poorly some people lived their lives, it shouldn't surprise him they'd be willing to rot in a wicker box. It saddened him, but Giallo Cofani had learned to adapt. And even if his company was forced to churn out cheap boxes undeserving of being called coffins, he would always have his precious collection. The warehouse, which was located in the wooded and secluded outskirts of Florence, housed a collection of the most unique coffins in the world. Only Giallo and a few of his closest, most trustworthy associates knew of the existence and location of this little museum. Some pieces were originals produced by Giallo Cofani, and others heralded from all across the globe. His collection included deluxe stainless steel caskets, marvelous bronze and copper creations, carved mahogany coffins decorated with crystals and hand-painted accents, and even a 24-karat gold-plated casket. As much as Giallo appreciated creativity, he frowned upon novelty coffins like the ones popular in Ghana, where people opted to be laid to rest in wooden lobsters or coffins designed to resemble boats or cars. His collection had no place for such vulgar displays of bad taste. Who in their right mind would want to be buried in a giant Coke bottle or next to a karaoke machine? He considered himself a staunch traditionalist, and no Kiss coffin would ever grace his treasured warehouse. Considering how much Giallo loved coffins, it was ironic that he'd once feared them as a boy. His dad would bring him to his factories in Brescia, north of Florence, where carpenters and craftsmen built the caskets that would soon welcome the recently deceased. His father was a cold, austere man with a sadistic streak. If he felt his son had disrespected him, and almost any behavior could trigger this perception, one day he might be too loud, another too quiet, the punishment was swift and horrific. He'd seal Giallo in a coffin and threaten to bury him alive. The first few times Giallo had been overcome with terror. Gradually, in the darkness, each successive breath becoming thinner, not knowing if this would be the last time he'd disappoint the old man, he changed. He began to look forward to his confinement, finding an inner tranquility in the dark that he couldn't duplicate in the bright world outside the coffin. Locked inside the box, he imagined being below the ground, the responsibilities and challenges of the living giving way to the peace of the dead. Punishment had become reward, a secret he never shared with his father lest his disciplinary tactics might change. As he grew to adulthood, his initial fascination with his family business turned into a bona fide obsession. It wasn't enough to make and sell coffins. He started collecting them, too. He'd track down the most unique caskets and coffins from around the world so he could lay in them, thereby recreating the feeling of peace he'd come to appreciate in his youth. Eventually, lying inside of them failed to achieve a sense of blissful transcendence. A more powerful outlet was needed, and that's when he turned to murder. The act came easy to Jallo, not surprising considering that death had been part of his life since the beginning. His victims were selected at random and buried alive. Experiencing their fear allowed him to relive his own delicious terror of being locked inside a coffin. As his collection expanded, so did the number of his victims. Their haunting faces remained burned in his memory, some terrified and pleading, others furious and defiant, but all of them full of life. By the time he dug them up, their expressions would be quite different. Even though their features might be distorted and grotesque, their eyes wide and the skin discolored, there would also be a sense of peace in their lifeless stares. Jallo had lost count of how many lives he'd taken in this manner over the years. He'd allowed himself to indulge his darker impulses when he told his men to place the American in one of his coffins. He had derived a sick rush from seeing his men hunt the boy through the maze-like collection, his terror providing Jallo with a visceral physical thrill better than any drug. But the time for fun and games was over. A different fate awaited the American. He wasn't just another victim to be added to the collection. He represented the key to Jallo's own future, a stepping stone to his impending transformation. He checked the time on his gold watch. Only 5 minutes had gone by since the burial of the American student, and he was already giddy with anticipation. A sharp whistling sound distracted Jallo. 10 feet away, his bodyguard, DeLuca's head snapped back in a spray of red, and the giant man crumpled next to the burial site. Instinctively, Jallo lurched behind a steel casket as more bullets chopped his coffins. Who would have the insolence to desecrate his collection in such a manner? His remaining men returned fire, and he saw 2 wooden caskets shatter. "Stop shooting, you idiots!" Didn't they realize the irreparable damage their careless action was causing his treasures? More shots stitched the wall behind him. Jallo couldn't wrap his mind around what was happening. No one knew about the warehouse and his collection. It made no sense. The gunfire ceased. Silence descended. Jallo cursed inwardly. How could he be experiencing such a setback when all the answers were within his grasp? They had to stop this shooter, whoever he might be. 3. A furious barrage of bullets ripped the mahogany coffin apart that Talon was using as cover. When the onslaught eased for a second, he popped up and returned fire, the bullets of his Glock lashing Jallo's unholy coffin collection. The stench of cordite hung in the air as more bullets erupted next to him. Jallo's men were trained professionals and clearly didn't plan to make this easy on him. Talon dipped below the coffin and crawled along the floor, now covered in wooden splinters, swiftly navigating the maze of caskets. He'd checked 2 of the coffins when he first broke into the warehouse and was well aware of their grisly contents. How many people had Jallo murdered and preserved during his 90 years on this planet? Too many to count. The man was as much of a monster as some of the nightmare creatures Talon had faced over the last 6 months. He'd seen some sick shit in his time as a Delta operator, but Jallo's warehouse of horror might just qualify for a spot at the top of the list. Now that the shooting had stopped, Talon was able to focus his still-ringing ears on other sounds. He detected a faint hint of incoming footsteps. Jallo's 2 assassins were closing in on him. His lips curled into a cruel smile as he eyed a titanium casket in front of him, his mind having formulated the beginning of a plan. 5 minutes later, one of Jallo's guards appeared inside the alley of caskets. He immediately made out the figure slumped in between the row of coffins. 3 bullet holes were visible in the downed man's back. He approached the body cautiously, never taking his eyes from his target. He didn't see the casket behind him pop open. He crouched before the corpse, and his cold eyes widened as he saw the mummified visage of a man long dead. When blood spattered the creepy mummy's face, he recoiled, too shocked to realize the red spray had come from his own perforated chest. An instant later, Jallo's guard collapsed next to the mummy. Talon slipped out of the casket from which he'd removed the decoy corpse. His eyes roamed the dark warehouse, his Glock leading the way. 1 guard remained, and then Jallo. Even though the sick mastermind behind this insanity was old enough to be his grandfather, he could still pose a threat. Even an old man could get lucky, and a bullet was lethal no matter what level of training the shooter might possess. One moment of inattention could change the tide of the battle. He had to keep his guard up. Eyeing the blood-flecked, mummified corpse, Talon wondered what sick demons drove Jallo. The question made Talon's mind return to 3 days earlier, when Simon Koska had first told him about the cursed coffin. 4.
Have you ever heard of the German stage magician Bruno Zamora, better known as Der Hexer?
Koska asked and took a sip of his Cabernet.
That's German for the sorcerer, by the way. Ring any bells?
Talon finished the last bite of his surf and turf and took a long pull from his Pilsner. Koska had invited him for lunch at a Silicon Valley seafood restaurant, and the food had lived up to its reputation. Judging from the serious tone in Koska's voice, it was time for business now. Talon scanned his memory and said, "Didn't Zamora give Harry Houdini a run for his money at one point?"
"You're quite right. Zamora and Houdini were bitter competitors, each of them trying to outdo the other. Certain sources claim Zamora took their rivalry one step further and sold his soul to the devil in exchange for the ability to practice real magic during his stage shows. Some of the tricks he performed still baffle magicians to this day, and according to the stories, he saved his best trick for last."
Koska slid his smartphone over to Talon. It showed a photograph of an ancient-looking coffin. The design was simple, almost austere, just a crude wooden casket. Talon zoomed in on the image, and more disturbing details became visible. Strange glyphs and sigils adorned the coffin's surface. Occult symbols Koska might know how to interpret, but were beyond Talon's knowledge, at least at this point in the game. There was something sickening about the cumulative effect of the cryptic patterns.
"What am I looking at?" Talon asked. "This is the casket that Bruno Zamora was buried in. Zamora vanished in 1905, suffering from ill health. Some believe he'd committed suicide and drowned in the North Sea near his hometown of Campen. In reality, Zamora's assistants had buried him on his property instead, the coffin remaining undiscovered until a recent construction project unearthed them."
Talon chewed over this and said, "All right, so why is this of interest to us? Don't tell me this was Dracula's coffin or I'll walk right out of here." Koska arched an eyebrow and said,
"The coffin was stolen a few weeks after its discovery. The German criminal Polizei even has a suspect. This man."
Koska swiped his phone and revealed the ancient features of Jallo. The picture perfectly captured the cold fire smoldering behind the man's eyes.
"Marco Jallo, heir to the Jallo Cofani dynasty, a fourth-generation coffin maker and rumored to be an obsessive collector of coffins."
"I guess everybody needs a hobby." This time a grin stole over Koska's face. "So you have contacts in the German police force?"
Koska's eyes narrowed. "I have contacts wherever underpaid government employees need to make ends meet."
"Point taken. So Jallo might have the coffin, and you want me to head to Florence to find out if he does?" Koska nodded. Talon frowned as he inspected the image of the coffin again.
"What makes the coffin so special? Are you familiar with the concept of soul transference?"
In the old days, Talon would have rolled his eyes at a question like this. Much had changed. "The occult practice of transferring one's soul into another body," he answered without hesitation. Koska sipped his wine and said,
"Zamora believed he could cheat death and be reborn in another, younger body. Tapping into Babylonian occult concepts of rebirth and reincarnation, he constructed a coffin capable of trapping his soul upon the moment of his death. It would prevent his spirit from passing into the next world."
For a second, Talon was reminded of the Reaper and fought back an involuntary shudder. He hoped Koska didn't expect him to go after another ghost so soon after the events in Ohio. He'd be better off calling the Spirit Breakers.
"Zamora's plan was simple," Koska continued. "He let his assistants bury his ailing body while still alive."
"Thereby allowing his soul to remain in the coffin," Talon said.
"Precisely."
Talon furrowed his brows. "So this was preferable to the afterlife, being trapped inside a moldy box at the bottom of an unmarked grave?"
"Not quite. This was only the first phase of the plan."
He swiped his phone again. A faded black-and-white photograph taken at the turn of the 20th century showed an older Zamora with a young man in his 20s.
Maximilian Geiger, a young protege of Zamora, and the man he'd handpicked to be the vessel of his rebirth. Once Zamora was dead, his assistants were supposed to dig up his body and place Geiger in the coffin with Zamora's remains. This second burial would allow Zamora's spirit to transfer from the coffin into the younger man.
Talon's jaw tightened with revulsion. Was there no limitation to human madness? How do you know all this? He asked.
Magic has always been a passion of mine. I was able to piece together much from Zamora's journal.
Talon studied Casca, and once again he mused that the man's dark interests clashed with his pretty boy good looks and stylish attire.
So what went wrong? He asked. They got cold feet. Never dug up their master, fearing they would hang for two murders.
Talon chewed it over. So we have this Jallo freak who's obsessed with coffins. He hears about the discovery of Zamora's casket and uses his money and pull to steal it. So what do you think he wants with the box? Bring Zamora back? Casca mulled it over for a beat before he spoke.
Good question. Having studied the man, I think he's trying to see if the stories are true. We're talking about a man in the twilight of his life. He may not be ready to meet his maker.
You think Jallo wants to use the coffin on himself?
It's the best theory I can come up with.
What happens with the soul of the replacement body? The grim expression on Casca's face spoke louder than words.
Murder is a small price for the chance at another lifetime. In theory, Zamora's coffin possesses the power to extend one's lifespan indefinitely. It's powered by black magic, however, so anyone who returns from the dead this way will become an agent of the darkness here on Earth. Jallo must be stopped before he gets a chance to use the coffin. I need you to go to Italy immediately.
Talon nodded grimly and flashed the billionaire a grin. I always wanted to visit the country of my ancestors. 5. Talon arrived in Florence 36 hours after his dinner with Casca. He checked in at his hotel, found his case of kit waiting for him, and began to do some surveillance on Jallo. The coffin collector was known for frequenting certain restaurants and bars in the area, so establishing the millionaire's routine became easy. Studying his new enemy proved informative. The men guarding the old coffin tycoon were seasoned pros, not ex-military, most likely former mafia enforcers whose skills had been honed in the Italian underworld. After shadowing Jallo for over a week, he got a lucky break when his quarry visited one of his regular hangouts. Talon was nursing a glass of tonic water at the bar when a fellow American took a tumble after one drink too many. The young girl he'd been chatting up wrapped her arm around him and, displaying more strength than one would expect from her tiny frame, dragged him to the back of the bar. The beauty, which Talon now recognized as one of Jallo's employees, must have slipped something in his drink. Talon followed both of them through the rear exit into an alley. He pressed himself against the wall, merging with the shadows as he witnessed the woman pulling the unconscious American into the trunk of Jallo's Maserati with the assistance of the coffin collector's security team. As much as Talon wanted to stop the kidnapping in progress and rescue the hapless American, he had to find out what Jallo wanted with the boy. He tailed the black Maserati as it fought its way through the city's narrow stone streets and a fleet of crazy taxi drivers. They left the city behind them and made their way through densely wooded outskirts. The Maserati turned onto a narrow trail, and Talon passed them, staying on the main road. Once the Maserati was out of sight, he performed a sharp U-turn and pulled onto the side of the road to wait. He wasn't worried. On these deserted forest streets, Jallo's security team would know they were being trailed. Fortunately, he'd planted a transmitter on the Maserati earlier in the week and would be able to resume his pursuit on foot within a few minutes. A half an hour later, he caught his first glimpses of Jallo's secluded warehouse. The fence barely slowed Talon down. After he cut his way through the chain-link mesh, he sprinted toward the Maserati parked next to the open main entrance. He slipped a black balaclava mask over his head and entered the warehouse, Glock in hand. Even though Talon tried to steel himself for whatever might be waiting within the walls of the structure, nothing could have prepared him for Jallo's coffin collection. The disturbing, surreal sight took Talon's breath away. There was a hushed, almost reverent silence to the place that made him feel like he'd set foot inside a vast cathedral. The dead commanded respect. It reminded him in a weird way of the time when he'd traveled aboard a C-130 Hercules military aircraft filled with the flag-draped caskets of soldiers who'd fallen in the Iraq War. He remembered thinking how clean all the flags looked in that country of dust. There were no flags inside Jallo's warehouse, but each coffin gleamed in the sunlight, pristine and meticulously maintained. The freak certainly loved his collection. Talon steeled his nerves and carefully opened the nearest casket. Inside, the pale, mummified corpse of a young woman lay on the pristine satin. A quick survey of half a dozen more caskets confirmed Talon's suspicions. Jala was not only a madman, but a mass murderer. He made a silent vow to himself. Soon, he'd add one more body to the collection. Marco Jallo. Maybe he'd even let the old man choose his own coffin. 6. Jallo stole nervous glances at his prized collection. Normally, gazing upon his coffins had a calming effect. Now he felt only dread. He was so close to finding out if the stories surrounding Zamora's famed coffin were true. This stranger shooting up the warehouse was liable to ruin everything. He cracked his knuckles, mentally reassuring himself that his men were some of the best killers money could buy. They would take care of the problem, a minor setback only. And then, gunfire echoed once more, and there was a distinct thump of a body tumbling against one of his coffins. It broke his heart to see his collection being damaged like this, and rage welled up, overpowering even his fear. He would make this intruder pay. All thoughts of retribution left his mind as the cold, hard barrel of a pistol dug into the back of his skull. Jallo saw Rolfo emerge from the maze of coffins, pistol leveled at the assassin who was holding him hostage, but his bodyguard was too far away to save him. "Drop the gun," the intruder with the gun commanded. He spoke Italian with a strong American accent. "I won't ask again." This was the voice of a man who didn't make idle threats, a voice much like Jallo's own. Rolfo still hesitated, and Jallo barked, "Do as he says, now!" The pistol hit the floor. "Now, start digging up the man you buried," the American intruder ordered.
"You don't understand," Jallo protested.
"I understand. Your sick experiment is over." The intruder had said experiment. Did the assassin know what he was trying to accomplish? But how? The theft of Zamora's coffin was well documented. Maybe it had drawn the attention of another occultist who might be after the prize of immortality. Rolfo began to dig. A pile of earth grew around him. Growing excitement replaced Jallo's fear. Would Bruno Zamora be reborn inside the body of the American, or would a blubbering, terrified child emerge from the coffin? Jallo tried to turn his head to catch a glimpse of the man with the gun. All he saw was a black balaclava and a tight combat suit. A man molded from darkness.
"Who are you? What do you want?"
He addressed the assassin in English, communicating that he was well aware of his national origins. "Shut the fuck up, freak." The disgust in the assassin's voice brought a smile to his face. A true killer like Jallo wouldn't be disturbed by his collection. The masked intruder might be a skilled assassin, but deep down he was weak. His lethal skill paled in comparison with the fire raging inside Jallo. The assassin nudged him with his Glock, indicating he should head for the open grave. Zamora's coffin sat at the bottom of the shallow wound in the earth. The wooden box held the answers to life's mysteries. Jallo licked his thin lips in anticipation.
"If you know the origins of this coffin, then you know what it does. A chance to conquer death itself, to live forever."
The assassin's mouth twisted into a cold smile. "For a man who worships the art of death, you sure seem squeamish about dying." The assassin eyed Rolfo and said, "Open the coffin." A low, insistent scratching noise emanated from within the casket, and an excited shudder shot up Jallo's bent, age-worn spine. The American student was alive, but whose soul resided in his body? Was it the American or Zamora reborn? Even Rolfo failed to mask his fear as he hunched over the coffin. Putting people into the ground was easier than digging them up. Motivated by the assassin's gun pointing at him, Rolfo jumped into the hole and, using a crowbar, he pried open Zamora's coffin. The lid flipped open and the American student glared back at them, his eyes wild and mad, his fingers bloody from trying to claw his way out of the wooden box.
"Warum hast mich nicht schneller zurückgebracht? Warum? Warum?"
The shrill intensity behind the guttural words reflected the speaker's insanity. They were spoken in German, and Jallo knew enough of the language to grasp the gist of the message. "Why didn't you bring me back sooner?" Elation filled Jallo's black heart. It had worked. The stories about the coffin were true. The body that now held Zamora's soul jumped out of the casket and launched into the nearest target, which, in this case, was poor Rolfo. Without hesitation, the American student sunk his teeth into the bodyguard's exposed throat with animal savagery. Blood gushed, and Rolfo cried out in pain and shock as he shoved the madman aside. Jallo sensed what might happen next. He wanted to cry out, but it was too late. Rolfo whipped out a knife from his belt and rammed it into the American student's heart. More German words reverberated through the warehouse, but as far as Jallo could tell, they were nonsense. The stage magician had obviously gone mad. Who wouldn't, after all this time? His soul had been trapped for 100 years inside the coffin, neither dead nor alive. A disembodied entity with nothing to occupy its mind but the memories of a life once lived and glories long faded. The student collapsed, spurting red, and by the time his body landed in the soil, his eyes had already glazed over. Fool. Rolfo followed suit and dropped into the dirt. Blood colored the ground scarlet as he twitched and clutched his throat. And then he, too, stopped moving. The black-masked assassins circled Jallo until they faced each other. The coffin collector was about to say something, but the steel in the assassin's eyes silenced him. I want you to know what's going to happen next. The assassin paused, and his iron gaze swept the warehouse. I'm going to burn down this cursed place.
You can't. My life's work.
Every coffin you collected will go up in flames. Jallo swallowed hard. Experience told him the assassin was the type of man who kept his promises. So his next words caught Jallo by surprise. And when this place is nothing but ashes, I'm going to give you what you want. 7. The warehouse burned, painting the air red. The fire's merciless heat singed Jallo's features as his prized collection went up in thick, oily clouds of black smoke. Tears streamed down his face, fury boiling inside of him as he bore witness to the inferno. If he were younger, he would have made a go at the black-clad assassin. The man had destroyed everything. They both stood outside the warehouse, and the assassin's gloved hand kept the Glock fixed on his head in case he should get any foolish ideas. The bastard wanted him to witness the destruction of his collection. What did he think he was doing? Punishing him for past crimes? What sort of mercenary was he dealing with here? Nevertheless, one piece had survived Jallo's collection. Zamora's coffin. The assassin had made sure to remove the casket from the warehouse before setting the charges that triggered the raging blaze. The fact that the coffin had been spared gave him hope. There was still a chance he might be able to start over again. If reborn through the coffin's magic, he could enjoy all his wealth inside a fresh young body. He could begin building a new collection. The assassin's words cycled through his mind. And when this place is nothing but ashes, I'm going to give you what you want the most. Was he implying that he could be bought for a price? That Zamora's coffin could be his for a price? Controlling his anger, Jallo said,
Whatever your employer is paying you, I can offer you more. Much more. Name your price.
The assassin's swift answer left little room for negotiation. Jallo felt the handle of the pistol bite into his head, and the world turned black. When he woke up, stars sparkled overhead, and for a moment he felt disoriented. He tried to move, but found himself confined, his hands cuffed. Craning his neck, he saw piles of dirt on either side of him. Instant realization hit him. He was looking up at the brilliant night sky from inside a wooden box. Not any box. Zamora's coffin, which now rested in a shallow grave. Above him, a shape stepped up to the grave. The assassin loomed like an angel of death. He removed his balaclava, revealing rugged, handsome features. Jallo choked back a wave of terror. The assassin didn't seem worried he'd ever get to pick him out of a police lineup. This was the end of the road.
What are you doing?
Jallo croaked, his heart hammering away. You wanted to be buried in Zamora's coffin. I'm making your wish come true. The assassin picked up the lid of the coffin. Jallo bit his lips with terror, grasping the fiend's plan. The American was going to bury him alive. He would indeed escape death, but he would remain trapped in the box in the same way Zamora's spirit had. Even if he should be lucky enough to have someone stumble upon his makeshift grave someday in the future. They would have no idea how to release him and bring him back from the dead.
Please, you can't do this,
Jallo said. How many of the people in your collection begged for their lives? How many did you spare? The question hung accusingly in the air.
Jallo's mind went blank as the heavy lid closed over the coffin, entombing him in blackness. He was suddenly 6 years old again and at the mercy of his father's madness. But this time there would be no reprieve. Light would not make way for the darkness. His interment would be permanent. The sound of dirt piling up on top of the coffin wasn't loud enough to drown out the coffin collector's horrified screams. We hope that you've enjoyed this production of Spirit Breaker and Coffin Collector by William Massa. This program was produced and narrated by James Foster. Copyright 2015 by William Massa. Production copyright 2015 by William Massa.